Welcome to The Literary Hangover. I'm your host, Matt Leck. With me, Alex Guns.
Hello.
And joining me for the first time is David Griscom.
I'm glad to be here.
Did I get your last name right?
You did.
Unlike another host of a podcast somewhere. David, tell us about yourself.
I'm originally from Texas. I'm a writer and I'm a researcher. I work on The Michael Brooks Show, and you can also check out my writings on thesynthome.com, which is my personal website.
How do you spell that?
SINTHOME.com.
Listeners might also know that I also work on The Michael Brooks Show. That's how we know each other. Today, we are talking about The Soul of Man Under Socialism, which is Oscar Wilde's only political essay, really. And some people even question how serious he is about it. I'm going to read from an essay by Peter Van de Kamp and Patrick Leahy. Is there a Patrick Leahy? Is Senator Leahy, is he, what's his first name?
Oh, shoot.
Isn't it Patrick? I might be wrong about that.
I think it might be.
Yeah, he's the United States Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont. He's the other, oh yeah, okay, that's right. And so this is not the same Patrick Leahy, I don't think. These two guys teamed up to write a pretty interesting essay called Some Notes on Wilde's Socialism. And it starts off like this. Oscar Wilde's The Soul of Man Under Socialism was first published in 1891, 3 years after the most influential English translation of the Communist Manifesto had appeared on the market, and at a time when social and government reforms formed the climate of the day. Up until the present day, Wilde's essay had received a varied response. Critics who emphasize Wilde's dandyism, his sophistications, and witty paradoxes stress the jocular side of his socialism. Of these critics, Michael Hardwick may be taken as example. He writes, if it is surprising to find the luxury-loving Wilde, social climber and eager mover in fashionable London society, propounding the ideal of a socialist utopia, it has to be remembered, on the one hand, that he delighted in astonishing his friends and confounding his enemies, and on the other, that his heart seemed to have been capable of feeling genuine compassion for the poor and the put upon. But basically that idea that you kind of just make it a trick, his socialism. When did you guys come to this essay, and what's your interpretive journey with it, I guess?
Well, this essay for me, actually, I read it pretty early on when I became, at least a socialist, if not a, Marxist communist. And it was actually very important to me because I always found the idea that, socialism has to be this drab, gray, miserable kind of political ideology to be very unappealing. And I always very much supported, like, the slur, for example, the attack against a lot of British socialists, that they were champagne socialists. Mm-hmm. Always felt was something we should wear with a badge of honor, honestly.
Right.
Is that we can promise, a better future and, enjoy the finer things in life. And that's something that we should be cultivating instead of eschewing.
Yeah. Alex, how about you?
I came to this particular essay and Oscar Wilde's essays in general through the arts and crafts movement, which... I knew people who were consider themselves like craftsmen in that field, and they make furniture and pottery is in that vein. And the manifestos of like Ruskin and Morris have this confluence of like Christian theology, socialism, and aesthetics that are like the my three bullet points of things that I'm deeply interested in.
Yeah. Well, how did you come along that path, the aesthetic stuff? Because I hadn't heard of I'd heard Ruskin's name.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't really heard of William Morris, I don't think. So how did you come across them?
For a brief period, I worked as a salesman for a company called Shackleton Thomas. This will be their plug. And they're a arts and crafts based furniture and pottery company based out of Burlington, Vermont.
Oh.
No, cut that. They're based out of Vermont, but I don't remember where.
That's fine.
They're based out of Vermont, and they had a pop-up store in Brooklyn, and I worked at an arts institution with their daughter. So they're deeply interested in making furniture that's of tactile use and also like has this artistic manifesto behind it, and the idea of like the craftsman and giving meaning by having a beautiful object was something as like a mid like in my mid-20s, I was like vehemently opposed to, on some, for some stupid reason, I preferred like a more like Spartan existence.
Right.
Probably because I had no money.
Yeah. Or my theory is that we've been conditioned to want a Spartan existence as a sort of like austerity, looking forward to climate change, which the elites always knew was coming.
Yeah.
But anyway, I digress.
No. Yeah. I think that's probably true. But the arts and crafts movement that this essay kind of lives in that milieu gives someone who's interested in social progress or equality, it gives you aesthetics as another tool for that like revolutionary purpose, mm-hmm. rather than something that, in spite of having these political opinions.
Yeah, it's funny. Oscar Wilde's relationship to the aesthetic movement. I have in the Cambridge Companion to Oscar Wilde, which I'm buying all these motherfucking things. I need to buy like some sort of, you know, bundle. Wilde came to America, which I didn't know, mm-hmm. until I might have like heard a little bit about it. But in 1881, the 23rd of April, Gilbert and Sullivan's Patience sort of satirized the aesthetic movement, including the character Bunthorne, the fleshly poet who was associated with Wilde. And then Wilde was invited by these impresarios associated with Gilbert and Sullivan to come teach alongside the play about what the aesthetic movement is. And in this Emmer O'Sullivan, Fall of the House of Wilde book that Elks and I have read, it talks about how basically that goes south when it turns out that, one, Wilde was picked. He was about like 27. He was picked because he was going to be, one, cheap, and two, they thought he was going to be a joke. And it turned out he could actually like lecture a little bit. And he was getting some like decent publicity. He had a lot of bad publicity too, but he had some decent publicity. But it's so funny to me with, let's say, elite universities hiring like adjuncts that are like younger than I am to teach certain classes, while students pay like a PlayStation and a half for each lecture. Mm-hmm. It's weird how time is a flat circle in that way. But Oscar Wilde, like we should almost return to this and just do a show on Wilde in America, because it's very interesting.
Yeah.
And he saw a lot of the country too, I believe. I think he went as far west as Colorado, right?
I think he might have even got to California.
Oh, wow.
He was here for an extended period of time.
Yeah, he was in St. Paul, Minnesota for St. Patrick's Day. gave a speech. This Some Notes on Wilde Socialism by Van de Kamp and Leahy touches a lot on William Morris. Another interesting thing that came from when Wilde was teaching that aesthetics, was doing those aesthetics lectures in 1882, is what America knew about that. I think in the Emmer O'Sullivan books, it talks about how like the really only signs of aestheticism was Morris wallpaper and like Queen Anne furniture and a few other things.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to touch on Morris at all?
Yeah.
Or more?
What do you have to say on Morris?
So I can give you like a brief overview. William Morris was kind of like a Renaissance man, but someone who didn't much care for the Renaissance. If the Renaissance was a way of like reviving the classics of antiquity, people like William Morris and his inspiration, John Ruskin, were someone who wanted to revive medievalism, or take aspects of medievalism and bring it into what they saw as this technocratic world that was losing any semblance of beauty. And Morris's mission was that art has a fixed place in society. And this was more also his mentor Ruskin's idea that art's idea, or I think it's William Morris says that art is an expression of man's pleasure of his labor. Mm-hmm. So when like art is being made not by an elite class, but actually by like a working class type of person. And it's almost like a unnecessary byproduct of these people that have a deep sense of connection and meaning with their work. And that's what he's pulling from what he perceives as the Middle Ages, which I think has been contested over and over again, whether that ever actually happened, like if the guild system was of any actual, like gave a shit about anything. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily matter for, Morris's mission, which he thinks that art, beauty, and aesthetics have a layer of meaning-making power that can be given to the laborer that's been stripped from them. Mm-hmm. Like his sense of, like, when Marx talks about alienation, Morris's way of injecting that back into the worker is through making something that's you can see the imprint of the worker on the finished piece rather than the worker making one single aspect of some very complex unit.
Yeah, there's a good documentary on YouTube on William Morris. If you just search that, I'll put a link to it in the show notes, where it goes about or it talks about how, him making his own home and basically handcrafting like every single portion of it. And that was a big Victorian thing. I'll just digress for a little bit. I was just in Phoenix over the weekend, and I went to the Rossin House, which is this Victorian-style mansion made by this guy who was a army doctor and then became like sort of like a big figure. I think he was mayor for 11 months in Phoenix. Made this Victorian-style house, and there's like the first floor, it's all like parquet floors and like amazing like ceiling stamped stuff. And Morris just went... Did he invent wallpaper? What's his relationship to wallpaper? Because it seemed like everyone talks about Morris wallpaper.
Yeah, he's... I mean, I think he split the difference between these like two modes of wallpaper that had been around for a long time, which is like the French style of wallpaper from the 19th and also the 18th century was this idea of like of almost as like close a representation to reality as possible. Like I want like something that looks exactly like a leaf or exactly like a tree. Which I think there's some witty jibe that Morris is like, well, why not just like rip off bark and put it on your wall? And then there's...
Hey, don't rule that out.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll see in like 20 years.
Property brothers.
Well, that's happening actually. A lot of like new architectures trying to create, working with a lot of like natural materials, especially the idea of a living building. And it's supposed to be a very green way to create space. I've been to when I was living in DC, I went to a couple of really interesting lectures on that specifically, where basically your walls would be alive. Would all be plants, and that's really good to insulate the building actually. And it's very green, obviously.
I gotta say, I want to make, if I had all the money in the world, I would make a Mandan Indian style, Earth Lodge.
Hell yes.
Like that shit's awesome. Anyway,
I guess that's a logical extension of, Frank Lloyd Wright's House on Falling Water with the river that goes through it.
Oh, that's a big influence, yeah.
But, and so then the other side of the coin for this wallpaper was geometric, which he, like, you could pull from, like, Arabic, but that was very popular English wallpaper design. So he split the difference by making, he wanted to make it look like nature, but with the laborer's impression. And that he seemed to have hit a chord, because that was his most, he ran a printing business for his books, and he ran furniture largely at a loss, and then stained glass, but it was just wallpaper that's probably his most...
And was he producing the wallpaper himself, or is
Him and a team of, I forget the amount of people, but he had this, like, this rotating team of expert craftsmen, and also at that time, like, in England, there was a lot of, like, working man's colleges that were opening up, and there was a real split between him and Ruskin, because Ruskin taught at these, like, working man colleges, which were, like, the first secondary education for people who, like, you know, didn't go past, like, the equivalent of third grade. And Ruskin saw it as a way not to, like, up, like, so they could have upper mobility, but just a way to, like, make their lives, like, better. Like, now you can enjoy art while you're poor. Whereas William Morris is like, I'm going to be cribbing these people for my, not my craftsman factory, basically, to make wallpaper.
Yeah, and Morris was also a writer himself. First, I want to talk about this wallpaper, because I don't know if it's the power of suggestion. It might be, like, if I didn't know this guy was, like, a sort of early socialist, I might not think, like, this stuff is beautiful. But now that I do, I'm like, I want to make this my iPhone background.
Well, if you look at my Twitter background, I have Charles Voicy's arts and craft wallpaper, who was a student of William Morris.
So what's going on? The arts and craft movement is still live and kicking then? Or what? How does that work?
It's not nearly as popular as it used to be, but it disseminates into broader culture like anything else. Like the plug I'll keep doing is that this company, Shackleton Thomas, is probably the most like direct descendant of arts and craft movement. But the idea of like, of something that you can see the craftsmen, you can see their work in their hand. Like, I don't know how to describe it. It's not necessarily like the organic movement, but there is something about you want something unique, not something that's like mass made necessarily, unless you go to like IKEA. But that impetus, I think, is so deep into culture now.
He's like the opposite IKEA. He's like the anti IKEA.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, one thing I note a lot about, you know, is sort of like my more idealistic criticism of capitalism is just how much everything is becoming more and more the same. And you notice that when you go into an apartment in New York or an apartment in Austin, Texas, like you have the cabinets are exactly the same. It can be very, you know, freaky. Or even, you know, when you think about something like a comb, right? It's like to have something that's like crafted, handcrafted comb. That's a very expensive, like luxury item versus something, you know, that was typically, that was typically what people would be able to experience for a lot of time.
Right. Yeah.
And it came to their tools.
And yeah, it's interesting because their criticism of Renaissance architecture in particular is for that exact reason, which is something that I feel like is lost on modern discourse, but that Renaissance art or Renaissance architecture is inspired by classical architecture of Greece and Rome, and that's hyper geometric, and they consider that really standoffish. Whereas Ruskin points out that that if you look at a Gothic cathedral, which he considers the height of architecture, you can see a lot of like mistakes, and there's no perfect circles, what he always says, and you can see like the laborer's imprint there, and like it. That's it.
Yeah. Well, this is something I've always sort of instinctually felt about architecture, which is that like brick buildings or like those older buildings where you can see it was like more manipulated by man, as opposed to like giant skyscrapers now where it's just like, yeah, we can pour the concrete and crane it that high. Like it's not, and then bolt it down. And like, you basically see all buildings inside are the same. Living in North Dakota, I had no idea about this, but I've seen enough buildings go working in Brooklyn, like, and like they, like when they go up, they all look the same, and everything else is just like how you structure the glass around it, basically.
Yeah. And both of them would say that architecture is like the perfect barometer to see how healthy a society is. That the more sterile that the architecture is, the more sickly in spirit the average laborer is.
Yeah, so I'll just continue with this Van de Kamp here. It has been claimed that Wilde's Soul of Man is an artistic and not a political manifesto. Yet such a claim is historically naive in the complex 19th century. A debate about the organization and control of society was almost constantly conducted by intellectuals and artists whose doctrines have largely set them off as Victorian prophets. I've never heard that phrase before.
Me neither.
They related the cultural decline of the English society to its social and political wrongs and promoted artistic appreciation as a cure for the capitalist disease. Carlyle, Ruskin, Arnold, and Morris observed that society had to change. They felt the prophetic desire to provide guidelines by which material and spiritual well-being could be obtained. Their influence on the social engagement of many late 19th and early 20th century authors is all too easily underrated. Wilde's interest in the soul of man has distinct Carlylean overtones. I haven't heard many good things about Carlyle. I know he invented the term cash nexus, which I don't know about.
Never knew that about him.
But I heard that's from Hobsbawm. And I think he might be a proto-fascist, but let's put a pin in that and come back to it. Maybe never. His stress on spirituality, his concern with the soul of man once material well-being has been secured under socialism, reflects the ideas of the Victorian prophets. And so with regards to Morris, we have some correspondence. This is from Wilde in 1891. Basically, Oscar Wilde is saying he obtained the receipt of Morris's book. It doesn't say in the text, but it's assumed that it's Morris's News from Nowhere, which a friend of the show, Corey Pine, that's why he named his podcast News from Nowhere. I believe that's right. It could be wrong. So they write, early in 1891, Wilde acknowledges the receipt of a book of Morris. "Dear Mr. Morris, the book has arrived, and I must write to you a line and tell you how gratified I am at your sending it. The book itself, if it is to have a suitable raiment, and blah, blah, blah." So he had it. What can be safely asserted is that Wilde had met Morris in 1881. Morris's letter to his wife, dated 31 March of that year, establishes this as their first meeting. Here's what Morris said. "Did the babes tell you how I met Oscar Wilde at the Richmond's? I must admit that as the devil is painted blacker than he is, so it fares with O.W. But not what he is an ass, but he certainly is, and clever too." They continue. Morris mentions Wilde again in a letter in 1884. The tone of which betrays their familiarity. I don't know whether you will be pleased, shocked, or amused to hear that Oscar Wilde has gone in for the Jaeger with enthusiasm. Wilde must have attended Morris's lectures on socialism in the 1880s, and if his views owe something to Morris, they owe it to his lectures. We'll see over the course of as we listen to the first half of this, that it kind of follows a lot of Morris's writings.
Yeah.
All right, but before we actually get to listening to the text, let's take a detour to his mother, her parents. So Wilde comes fairly well-off parents in Irish parents, or Anglo-Irish, I believe they were, lived in Marion Square, Dublin. Is that mentioned in Ulysses?
Oh, surely.
Yeah.
But that's been too long.
And his dad is basically a polymath. He's a sort of general practitioner or surgeon or something like that. There's certain incisions. There's a Wilde's incision, which is right behind the ear, I think, to take care of ear infections or something like that. It's still called that to this day. He was also an antiquarian. And that's, I think we've mentioned earlier about this period of time being one where nationalism, governments are putting together resources to try to build like mythologies and histories. So basically the Irish government was trying to do something with all these artifacts and cataloging them. And William Wilde came around and was like, I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically did it.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially of like the pre-Christian past of Ireland was something he was deeply interested in. He even moved the family to live in a place that he assumed some mythic battle took place at. Sadly, it's actually never happened, but
hey,
it's his commitment.
You can't win them all.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, his son Oscar wouldn't have thought that mattered. Facts don't matter.
That,
to quote Bodega Boys, Oscar Wilde was early on that train. That's why he converted to Catholicism. But he had a lifelong flirtation with Catholicism, even though he was a sort of Oxford atheist.
Yeah.
Not to be outdone, his mother was basically a agitator in the press, and I want to play a little bit from this Emma O'Sullivan book that we keep referencing. It's a really, really good book. Highly recommend it.
Chapter 5. The Bourgeois Rebel. After the Act of Union in 1801, Ireland was directly governed from Westminster as part of the United Kingdom. The British government directly appointed a Lord Lieutenant and a Chief Secretary with executive responsibilities for Ireland. And Ireland elected 105 members to the House of Commons. Most were Protestant landlords. From 1829, following the Act of Catholic Emancipation, Irish Catholics could be elected to sit in Parliament, but it took time before any were. And for two centuries, the 17th and 18th, Irish Catholics had been prohibited from purchasing or leasing land, voting, holding public office, obtaining education, entering a profession, and doing many other things necessary for a person to live, let alone succeed, in society. During the late 1840s, mass disease and emigration caused over 1 million deaths and a further 1 million to emigrate, reducing the population by a quarter from 8 to 6 million. Known as the Great Famine, the ostensible cause was potato blight. The blight ravaged crops across Europe, but the impact on Ireland was disproportionate. A third of the population relied on the potato for a range of ethnic, religious, political, social, and economic reasons. While many died of hunger, Ireland continued to export large amounts of food, including butter, wheat, and other grain and vegetable crops. Between 30 and 50 shiploads a day went to Britain, sufficient to have fed the Irish population. The absurdity of exporting food, combined with the draconian laws of the time, have led some historians to use the term genocide. Famine worsened the already strained relations with the British Crown and became a rallying cry for home rule movements. Jane Elgee, Oscar's mother, first came to public attention by writing poetry and articles for a literary journal called The Nation. Her first contribution was in 1846 when she was 25. She wrote under a pseudonym, using either John Fanshawe Ellis or Speranza. One of her first poems, The Faithless Shepherds, written at a time when famine was extreme, takes as its central theme the failure of moral leadership. The poem imagines landlords as cold, disengaged, inhumane, failing in their social duty. Dead, dead, ye are dead while ye live. Ye've a name that ye live, but are dead. Neither counsel nor love did ye give, and your lips never uttered a word, while swift ruin downward sped, and the plague raged on undisturbed. Not a thought in the dull, cold brains of how ye should bear your part, when summoned the strife to brave for your country, with death and the grave. In France in 93, published in The Nation on the 27th of March 1847, Jane took the bread riots during the French Revolution as analogous to the famine in Ireland. The poem pictures an Armageddon, as a volcanic surge of mass violence is the price paid by a negligent monarch. Ghastly fruit their lances bear, noble heads with streaming hair. Royal blood of king and queen streameth from the guillotine. Wildly on the people goeth, reaping what the noble soweth. Undoubtedly this was meant to discomfort those responsible or complicit in the mismanagement of famine.
Hell yeah. I love that line.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, that was when I'm like, oh yeah, this book, I see what Alex is talking about.
Yeah.
But I'll just spell a little bit more here.
Such poems led many to condemn the nation as subversive. Leigh Hunt, the English poet and journalist, liked the trumpet-like music and political vigor of the writings, but was startled by the vehemence. Established in 1843 by Thomas Davis, John Blake Dillon, and Charles Gavan Duffy, The Nation was a literary journal designed to broaden awareness of culture. It was the vocal arm of the Young Ireland movement, whose motto was, "Educate that you may be free." Davis, the inspiration behind the movement, believed that political independence should be accompanied by mental independence and by the self-confidence that comes from education, self-expression, and taking initiative.
And we co-sign all those here, all those lofty goals, as yeah. well as the reapeth what the noble soweth. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's Oscar Wilde's mom, Lady Wilde. She would go on to... Wilde tried to get her published a few times when he had his fame, but basically Wilde's father was a bit of a philanderer himself and started having an affair with one of his patients, and that became a big trial for libel. And then shortly after that, I think Wilde's father died, maybe, and then Lady Wilde was left with the kids, William Wilde and Oscar.
You didn't say, well, also he kind of left them in like a pauper situation.
Yeah, had a bunch of debt. So that's interesting to note, like Wilde's background. It wasn't just like wealthy parents. It mm-hmm. was like well-to-do parents, but also ones that that had like very specific political leanings and sharpened political leanings. It's actually like it makes sense when you see what Wilde became. Like,
certainly,
this is the milieu he came from.
I think you could probably say that the salon that the Wildes ran, and then solely by Lady Wilde, that pretty much helped birth the Irish Renaissance after that. Mm-hmm. Like with Yeats was a big proponent of Lady Wilde and saying a lot of what his point of view on like this kind of left-leaning and Irish independence thing that were coming out of the discussions in their living room for the most part.
Yeah, that's so in some ways Wilde's mother was more of a radical than he was. Although I think Emma O'Sullivan, or maybe it's another, maybe it's in the who's the Richard Ellman biography, which is also good, talks about how she had a sort of similar distrust of the mob that Wilde occasionally exhibited in certain poems. He's very wishy-washy on certain, or not wishy-washy, but he'll like he's very strong on both sides of the fence, depending on what side he's on. So I think with that that mention, we can go to the actual recording of this. Now, Alex, do you want to say a few words on the narrator for this? We have a LibriVox narrator again.
You know, I mean, in my weaker moments, I'd say he's annoying. But I think what Martin Giessen does is yeoman's work, like every other LibriVox recorder. And so I'm in
right.
his debt that he's gone through a lot of Wilde's work. But he really leans into the characters and this kind of musical presentation. That doesn't lend itself to, I think, long-form reading. That's my own. But if he wants to keep doing what he's going to do, he should just keep doing
it. Yeah, I mean, Alex is entitled to his opinion. I don't agree. I think you get out there, Martin. I think he's doing a really good job.
Oh, wow. This is great. Yeah, Alex, what do you think about this? Oh, yeah. It's actually amazing what he does, and Alex is a fucking nut.
I think... well, actually, no. I'll just say I am typically... I think, not unique, but... what another word sort of approaching that, which is that I like Frederick Davidson. Have you ever heard of him?
Read Maybe. It?
Everybody hates the way he speaks, but I think like you just got to get over it and just you got to not.
It's not bothering me. I don't know.
You're off trial.
Okay.
This is just generally speaking. Because I listen to so many like text to speech audiobook stuff. Oh. So it's like, how can I really complain about like another human being like narrating? And I have, yeah, Alex, I'm not doing this to attack you or set you up and get Martin Gleason.
He's going to play recordings of my voice and how horrible it is.
Yeah, I don't want Martin Gleason to come after you. Oh, here's Frederick Davidson. That's what he sounds like. This is him doing Such Were the Joys by George Orwell.
Make me spew, still in his ears, were holy. And he was born knowing what I had learned out of books and slowly.
He sounds like Martin Amis.
Yeah.
Yeah. It grew on me. Like at first, because he also does, I think, like War and Peace. So like,
oh, wow.
Jesus.
You're with that guy for a long time.
Yeah. I don't mind that guy either. But yeah, he gets savaged on the Audible comments. Like, I had to turn it off.
Yeah. And I'm just like, you know what? You're only impoverishing yourself. That's the lesson. So I just wanted to say that, just get clear the air, because some people might not like this recording. But guess what? You record one.
Turn off. Just turn the podcast off.
You record your own socialism or turn it off. Yeah, frankly, I don't need listeners like
that. Yeah, fellow traveler. I will say Flo Gibson, she does suck. That's the only one that I think she shouldn't be doing audiobooks.
And we did her last week.
Yeah, But she's getting paid though, so I'm fine saying that. She's not doing it on LibriVox.
No, yeah. Yeah, she's done a bunch. Okay, so here is the LibriVox version of The Soul of Man. And we're going to do the first half of this, and the rest of it is available to you if you want to continue. The second half is a little bit less political, though there are some things in there. It's more about artwork. And Wilde's like, let me be a fucking artist, please. Which is fine, but it's just a bit less interesting for the purposes of this. Okay.
Section 1 of The Soul of Man. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Martin Gleason.
Hell yeah.
The Soul of Man by Oscar Wilde.
Oh.
Section 1.
I should note, he just says The Soul of Man by Oscar Wilde there. The original title is The Soul of Man Under Socialism. It was reprinted, I think after Wilde was imprisoned, but still alive, as just The Soul of Man. And,
interesting.
Yeah. And it's funny that excision, because, we've talked about the excision of, George Orwell's democratic socialism in the preface to, Animal Farm. It says, like, since the Spanish Civil War, every word I've written has been against totalitarianism. And then there's an ellipses, and what's in the ellipses is, and for democratic socialism. And, I think it was Penguin or Signet Classics is like, yeah, we're not going to put that. It's the '50s. This is going into classrooms.
Yeah. Yeah.
it had a lot of consequences, honestly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see Orwell being quoted by every right-wing jerk off.
Well, I don't know if we'll get to it, but there is a right-wing YouTube site that has its own little video on The Soul of Man.
Wait, like pro?
Libertarianism.org.
Oh, well, yeah.
Okay.
3. From The Soul of Man Under Socialism.
We're going to go
Oscar
fast.
Oscar Wilde. Originally published in the Fortnightly Review, February 1891. Oscar Fingal O'Flaherty Wilde, 1854 to 1900, was an Irish essayist, playwright, novelist, and intellectual in Victorian England. In 1895, Wilde was convicted of gross indecency.
We don't need to know this, but anyway, the libertarians are claiming Wilde. And from a certain perspective, like, Wilde does talk a lot about individualism, and that's an aspect I think that probably won. One of the few concepts here that, like, well, we can talk about that.
No,
like,
we definitely should.
Yeah, because, like, what individualism really means. So libertarianism.org thinks they got Wilde on their team here.
Jesus Christ.
This is what we're doing. We're doing some cultural triage here. is that the word?
Triage? Maybe.
For the medical term?
Oh, I don't know.
I'm not sure.
I famously failed out of medical school.
All right, here we go back to Martin Giessen.
The chief advantage that would result from the establishment of socialism is undoubtedly the fact that socialism would relieve us from that sordid necessity of living for others, which in the present condition of things presses so hardly upon almost everybody. In fact, scarcely anyone at all escapes. Now and then, in the course of the century, a great man of science, like Darwin, a great poet, like Keats, a fine critical spirit, like Monsieur Renan, a supreme artist, like Flaubert, has been able to isolate himself, to keep himself out of reach of the clamorous claims of others, to stand under the shelter of the wall, as Plato puts it, and so to realize the perfection of what was in him, to his own incomparable gain, and to the incomparable and lasting gain of the whole world.
So right there, we already have major Wildean sort of paradoxes, right? The switching, like, socialism is just so you can stop worrying about other people.
Yeah.
Which is, like, the exact sort of inversion of conservatives complaining, take care of yourself, like, stop being a victim on behalf of other people, sort of thing.
Yeah, there's almost like a way that he's like reclaiming individualism from reactionary thought by saying, like, actually we're the true individualists.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And the idea, and I think we'll develop this as the text goes on, but the idea of living for others becomes very interesting for Wilde, because, you know, there's a tension there, because socialism is, you know, by its name, is supposed to be social. Mm-hmm. So the idea of being able to hold yourself away and to create art, you know, creates a tension right from the very beginning of the text.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I'm just curious, and I think, you know, especially, I guess, you know, if we do get into the second half where he starts to talk about his aesthetic theory, it does become interesting that he really does believe this idea that to be able to create any kind of art, you have to isolate yourself from everyone else.
Yeah.
And that's strange, because it's like, I don't know if he's, because he was a very social person himself, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, not only that, he's also a notorious plagiarist.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's a common thing it's way more common than people realize. We sort of talked about this with, I mentioned Orwell. Like, the reason he sounds so Marxist is because he's in conversation with other Marxists that we just don't remember these days. Mm-hmm. And the same thing was with Wilde, right? He's like, he has the William Morris lectures. He's like friends with Kropotkin. I don't know. I completely forgot where I was going with that.
But I think, you know, just in this first text, it's important to recognize, but what he means by isolation is like keeping himself out of the claims of others, which is very different from, you know, holding yourself away or going off into the woods to write your great novel. It's like without having people to have ownership over you and your ideas, basically, to be able to stand outside of society, you know, even if you're living in it, to be able to stand outside of it as an individual, as a writer, as a thinker, is how you're creating art.
Yeah, it's like the dandy paradox that he seems to live in, which is like he's this commentator on society. In like the Shakespearean sense of like all the world's a stage, he's standing right off stage being like, I'm in on this with you, to the audience, but commenting on society the entire time without looking to change it, because that would change his identity as like the dandy irrevocably. So he wants to make a world of dandies in which there will be no dandies.
That's true.
The condition of things presses so hardly upon almost everybody. In fact, scarcely anyone at all escapes. Now and then, in the course of the century, a great man of science, like Darwin, a great poet, like Keats, find himself out of reach of the clamorous claims of others, to stand under the shelter of the wall, as Plato puts it, and so to realize the perfection of what was in him, to his own incomparable gain, and to the incomparable and lasting gain of the whole world. These, however, are exceptions. The majority of people spoil their lives by an unhealthy and exaggerated altruism, are forced indeed so to spoil them. They find themselves surrounded by hideous poverty, by hideous ugliness, by hideous starvation. It is inevitable that they should be strongly moved by all this. The emotions of man are stirred more quickly than man's intelligence. And as I pointed out some time ago in an article on the function of criticism, it is much more easy to have sympathy with suffering than it is to have sympathy with thought. Accordingly, with admirable though misdirected intentions, they very seriously and very sentimentally set themselves to the task of remedying the evils that they see. But their remedies do not cure the disease. They merely prolong it. Indeed, their remedies are part of the disease. They try to solve the problem of poverty, for instance, by keeping the poor alive, or in the case of a very advanced school, by amusing the poor.
March Madness.
But this is not a solution. It is an aggravation of the difficulty. The proper aim is to try and reconstruct society on such a basis that poverty will be impossible. And the altruistic virtues have really prevented the carrying out of this aim. Just as the worst slave owners were those who were kind to their slaves, and so prevented the horror of the system being realized by those who suffered from it, and understood by those who contemplated it, so in the present state of things in England, the people who do most harm are the people who try to do most good. And at last we have had the spectacle of men who have really studied the problem and know the life, educated men who live in the East End, coming...
That sounds a bit MAGA, or like, look at these elites telling us what to do.
Well, I mean, I'm a little out of my depth here, but isn't that kind of like a left criticism of liberalism, that they just prolong the debilitating state of being in a capitalist world?
Oh yeah, this is the classic critique of philanthropy that people still make today about, like, basically this is tax deductible. So anytime some rich asshole talks about his foundation, it means like that's what he's doing to get around paying taxes.
What, not only being tax deductible, but also the idea that, you know, their wealth creates the poverty that everyone else is suffering in. And the idea is that the people who are the philanthropists, right, they already have a lot of material power and political power because of that. Now they're also trying to wield even more power over people's life by being the ones who give them charity, deciding how they give it and what they give it to, and controlling, you know, social engineering in that aspect.
Right. And it's sort of like how, like, the Sacklers with Guggenheim and stuff like that. Like, oh, thank God we have the Koch brothers and the Sacklers to give us, like, art. Otherwise we wouldn't have it in our lives.
Guggenheim announced they're not going to be taking any more money from the Sacklers.
I saw that, yeah.
So that kind of but this point of view also is cribbed from the arts and crafts movement. That was a big thing with Ruskin, saying that he never argued that the medieval world was any more just or fair than the current world, but it wasn't hidden. Like, that class identity was much more clear, and then it was much more righteous in that sense. Where the fact that the rich and powerful pretending to come down and help you, that's the disgusting thing about modernity for arts and crafts people.
So this is going back to the Van de Kamp and Leahy article on page 142. The force that has enslaved the working class is the result of the institution of private property and private enterprise. This force is kept in existence by the bourgeois, the parasites of private property, as Morris and Shaw call them, who endeavor to ease their conscience concerning their poor slaves by means of charity. Yet charity remains a substitute for real and selfless help, and it artificially preserves the inequalities between rich and poor, between the rich and the poor. Morris observed that, quote, a rich man cannot give to a poor one without both being worse for it. And then Wilde adds, which we're going to get to shortly, it is immoral to use private property in order to alleviate the horrible evils that result from the institution of private property. It is both immoral and unfair. Both Morris and Wilde, contrary to Shaw, agree that the working class should revolt against their inhuman position in capitalist societies. Morris holds that, quote, it would be better for the community and for the worker if the latter were to fold his hands and refuse to work, and either die or let us pack him off to the workhouse or prison, which you will. And Wilde comments that the best among the poor are never grateful. So we already see a sort of influence of Morris on Wilde here.
So in the present state of things in England, the people who do most harm are the people who try to do most good. And at last we have had the spectacle of men who have really studied the problem and know the life, educated men who live in the East End, coming forward and imploring the community to restrain its altruistic impulses of charity, benevolence, and the like. They do so on the ground that such charity degrades and demoralizes. They are perfectly right. Charity creates a multitude of sins.
I just want to look up what he meant by that East End thing, because I first thought that was a reference to, like, the philanthropists, mm-hmm. the rich philanthropists, but it looks like it's, like, the critics of philanthropists, but maybe from the right. So I want to... here's what the footnote says. Educated men who live in the East End. Toynbee Hall, founded in the deeply impoverished Whitechapel district of London by Oxford University men, was a residence intended to bring together educated people... bring together educated and poor people on terms of fellow feeling and practical help. It gave the model to innumerable other settlement houses in Britain and America, including Jane Addams' famous Hall House in Chicago. So I'm not super familiar with what that means, but interesting.
They are perfectly right. Charity creates a multitude of sins. There is also this to be said. It is immoral to use private property in order to alleviate the horrible evils that result from the institution of private property. It is both immoral and unfair. Under socialism, all this will, of course, be altered. There will be no people living in fetid dens and fetid rags, and bringing up unhealthy, hunger-pinched children in the midst of impossible and absolutely repulsive surroundings. The security of society will not depend, as it does now, on the state of the weather. If a frost comes, we shall not have 100,000 men out of work, tramping about the streets in a state of disgusting misery.
Climate change.
Now, on the weather... If a frost comes, we shall not have 100,000 men out of work, tramping about the streets in a state of disgusting misery, or whining to their neighbours for alms, or crowding round the doors of loathsome shelters to try and secure a hunch of bread and a night's unclean lodging. Each member of the society will share in the general prosperity and happiness of the society, and if a frost comes... no one will practically be anything the worse. Upon the other hand, socialism itself will be of value simply because it will lead to individualism. Socialism, communism, or whatever one chooses to call it, by converting private property into public wealth and substituting cooperation for competition, will restore society to its proper condition of a thoroughly healthy organism, and ensure the material well-being of each member of the community. It will, in fact, give life its proper basis and its proper environment. But for the full development of life to its highest mode of perfection, something more is needed. What is needed is individualism. If the socialism is authoritarian, if there are governments armed with economic power, as they are now with political power, if, in a word, we are to have industrial tyrannies, then the last state of man will be worse than the first. At present, in consequence of the existence of private property, a great many people are enabled to develop a certain very limited amount.
Some pretty good foresight, I feel like, about the industrial tyrannies. And, like, to this day, we have all of our economic sort of means in charge of capitalists who mm-hmm. don't have any duty but to their shareholders, basically.
And wasn't this, though, because it is very interesting, obviously, because when we hear this, I feel like our imaginations are skipping forward, like, 40 years to, you know, Stalin, the Soviet Union. But... you know, I think that when he's talking about authoritarian socialism, there were a lot of utopian novels that were going on right then. The book was Looking Backward.
Looking Backward.
Yeah. And that was supposed to be something that was like much more like everyone had to do military service and like your whole life was so structured by the state. Uh-huh. And it was very popular with people. So he was very much like, you have these interesting, you know, tensions there as well, where it's like even among the utopian folks, right? Because it's like, you know, like a good Stalinist would make the argument, right? Is that like the power, and I mean that, you know, the power of the state, the reason the state had so much power was because of the rest of the world was basically trying to collapse the Soviet Union externally. So it was more of a reaction to a problem versus these utopian socialists who were actually arguing for that as a positive thing that mm-hmm. gave people meaning, which I think is, you know, there's a difference there actually.
Yeah. And actually we will do Looking Backward, at some point. I've read that. There's actually the very first LibriVox book I ever discovered was Looking Backward. I got assigned it for a class, and for some reason I had the idea to like just put it into the iTunes search. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Like, I'm like, I don't want to read this. I was like new to Audible, so I was like getting into the audiobook mode. And then I'm like, but maybe there's something out there. I was actually looking for lectures or something. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, the entire thing is right there. And that was the very first one. It is very interesting. The only thing, I don't remember much about the military conscription, but I think I've heard that subsequently, but it was a huge bestseller, mm-hmm. just massive, both sides of the pond. Bellamy, I think maybe he was British. I can't remember. No, I think he was American. But anyway, I remember the one image I have was like the sidewalks would have sort of umbrellas that would follow you along, like machine umbrellas. Like it's a lot of like machinery utopia, mm-hmm. Stuff that's interesting here. I also wanted to bring up, at the start of that paragraph, Wilde says, socialism, communism, or whatever one chooses to call it. That's a funny thing. Like the flippancy with terminology mm-hmm. is something I kind of appreciate. But I like to like basically like triangulate different people's perspectives on it. Do you have?
No, and I do like that, you know, how he's playing with the terms, but I think it's something that I highlighted this and something that's important to me mm-hmm. is his fixation on the question of private property.
Yeah.
Because a lot of socialists today, especially in the United States, in my experience, they don't have like the question of private property isn't central to their analysis. It's very much as like, okay, we need to alleviate suffering and, you know, create like larger social programs, which is in a lot of ways is very similar to the kind of like charity argument that Wilde is pushing against. Right. So taking the private property question as his central criticism of capitalism or the state that he's in is something that's very brave. And I think that, you know, we should pay attention to.
Yeah. And can you just make the distinction for people between like private property and personal property that I think confuses a lot of people when they hear this?
So, you know, no one is going to come, you know, so private property is not your Xbox. Mm-hmm. You know, private property.
Oscar Wilde. Matt specifics at Xbox.
Oscar Wilde wants to abolish Red Dead.
Yeah. You know, but private property is the land, the factory. You know, the means of production.
Right.
And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about private property specifically. It's that what is used by many people, but is owned by a few.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, get the fuck out of here. So Wilde in this, there's this very funny. Interview he did with the theater in 1894, which is like sort of right at the end of the Wilde's 90s. Like it goes from 89 to 95 and then like shit starts hitting the fan. Mm-hmm. This is 94 after like a lot of his big works are out there. He's interviewed by this theater writer. Let's see.
This is definitely the interview of someone who's like at the peak of his power. It's like, I'm just going to talk. And we'll just see what happens.
Yeah. So I don't have who the interviewer is, but it starts off the and this is interesting in the context of the Dreyfus affair and Wilde knew Zola, Emile Zola, who wrote J'accuse about that and basically anti-Semitism in France. Similar sort of trial as Oscar Wilde's. Like there's anti-Semitism and homophobia. Mm-hmm. This writer I was interviewing Wilde starts, he likes Jews. He has many friends among the Hebrews. He thinks Spinoza a very fine character. He seems to have some doubt as to whether Spinoza was really the founder of the pantheistic sect. I'm not really sure what that's a reference to, but it's funny just to say he likes Jews. Okay. Get that on the record.
Yeah.
The conversation drifted into politics. Quote, we are all of us more or less socialists nowadays, he remarked. Our system of government is largely socialistic. Now, that is often omitted, too, I think, to maybe blunten what he's saying about we're all socialists. Because, mm-hmm. I think, you know, Republican and Democratic democratizing government is, very – those are victories, but also, not – I wouldn't say like the House of Commons is socialism. I mean,
yeah,
but
it's pretty wild.
He's the kind of guy who would say, like, I feel like in that same interview, he'd be like, oh, like, what are police? Like, those are socialists.
Yeah, exactly. This is a police are socialism argument. Our system of government is largely socialistic, but then Wilde continues. Oh, yeah, he says, what is the House of Commons but a socialistic assembly? Then he says, I think I am rather more than a socialist, he added laughingly. I am something of an anarchist, I believe, but, of course, the dynamite policy is very absurd indeed. Which, like, to me, it's somewhere, it's basically, like, where all these conversations now get to. Mm-hmm. Like, I think everybody sort of distrusts the state. And then also thinks like, but fuck, we need to do something with it.
Well, and you know, this is something, and I feel like a lot of the secondary literature about this text gets into it, is the question of whether or not, you know, Oscar Wilde's socialism is utopian. Mm-hmm. And just to, you know, so people understand is that, you know, for example, Marx wasn't the first socialist. Marx was actually reacting and writing against the popular movements for socialism, specifically in France and also in the United Kingdom, and trying to put a rigor on them. You know, and that's something that's very different from what Wilde is coming from.
Yeah, we talked about one of those in the House of the Seven Gables. Do you remember what that his name was?
Like Proudhon?
No. That utopian socialist, basically, Holgrave is like says or no, Vedder says Holgrave sounds like or no, Holgrave says Vedder's plans are like the guy. Damn, I don't know. Yeah, Charles Fourier, who I think had like he had like an idea for society. He had down to the specific number of people you wanted.
They always do that.
Yeah, it was like 1600 like, or something.
Wasn't that like Plato's thing? Like everyone had to be an equal amount. Like there has to be an equal number of builders and teachers. Or something. Yeah, it's like, what are you like, talking about?
Yeah, like come on, yeah. Man. This is more about your OCD or something.
And it's like you know, and there's a big difference between having like the correct sympathy and orientation versus like having a plan. And that was sort of was very much like what the Marxist project was to try to you know create a little bit of discipline amongst these people who were talking about shit like that all right. the time, so I don't know if I can curse.
You know, go ahead. Fourier is very funny, though, because he was the guy, I think, in the clip we played in the Seven Gables episode where he had the specific schematic cell ready for it, and he was just like, why won't some rich person come give me the money to do
oh,
this?
Oh, now I remember yeah. this. Yeah.
Oh, that's wild.
Yeah. So yeah, nice little, and it's interesting. I mean, we'll get to whether Wilde is utopian or not. Mm-hmm. I think it's more ambiguous than people say, but that's sort of towards the end of the episode. But also, William Morris's book, News from Nowhere, that's a utopian title right there. It's from nowhere.
I think in this essay, Oscar Wilde is absolutely disinterested in the struggle to get towards socialism. If anything, I think he sees it as he collapses the difference between Darwinian evolution and the march towards socialism as it's just the next evolutionary step of man's progress. Like that's the end terminus is this utopia from which we'll see the utopias that we don't have a vantage point to yet. So he's not even worried about like the potential upheaval, I think. If I'm to like read between the lines that he's like, we're all going to get there eventually. So I'll just talk about what it could possibly be like when we get there.
Exactly.
Yeah, and what it's going to be for the artists. Cause that's
But we're all going to be artists.
Right.
Be worse than the first. At present, in consequence of the existence of private property, a great many people are enabled to develop a certain very limited amount of individualism. They are either under no necessity to work for their living, or are enabled to choose the sphere of activity that is really congenial to them, and gives them pleasure. These are the poets, the philosophers, the men of science, the men of culture. In a word, the real men, the men who have realized themselves, and in whom all humanity gains a partial realization. Upon the other hand, there are a great many people who, having no private property of their own, and being always on the brink of sheer starvation, are compelled to do the work of beasts of burden, to do work that is quite uncongenial to them, and to which they are forced by the peremptory, unreasonable, degrading tyranny of want. These are the poor, and amongst them there is no grace of manner, or charm of speech, or civilization, or culture, or refinement in pleasures, or joy of life. From their collective force, humanity gains much in material prosperity, but it is only the material result that it gains, and the man who is poor is in himself absolutely of no importance. He is merely the infinitesimal atom of a force that, so far from regarding him, crushes him, indeed prefers him crushed, as in that case he is far more obedient. Of course it might be said that the individualism generated under conditions of private property is not always, or even as a rule, of a fine or wonderful type, and that the poor, if they have not culture and charm, have still many virtues. Both these statements would be quite true. The possession of private property is often extremely demoralizing. And that is, of course, one of the reasons why socialism wants to get rid of the institution. In fact, property is really a nuisance. Some years ago, people went about the country saying that property has duties.
His mom.
They said it so often and so tediously that at last the church has begun to say it. One hears it now from every pulpit. It is perfectly true. Property not merely has duties, but has so many duties that its possession to any large extent is a bore. It involves endless claims upon one, endless attention to business, endless bother. If property had simply pleasures, we could stand it, but its duties make it unbearable. In the interest of the rich, we must get rid of it.
That's another one of my favorite lines. Like, it's for them. It's for their own good. It's because Elon, you're working too hard. You're overworked. You're working, what, 90-hour days like every rich person says they do, which what they mean, like, half of that is, like, checking email in the Uber, I feel like.
Mm-hmm. And accusing people of pedophilia.
Yeah.
That's work.
Accusing people who saved kids underwater in a collapsed cave, was that right?
Yeah.
Of being pedophiles because of the country that
he's in Thailand, everybody.
Saying it's sus and saying he has proof. I was hoping on the outside chance it was like Peter Thiel had given him some information that he hacked with his CIA spy firm. Like, yeah, this guy actually is a pedophile. In which case, like, Elon Musk might think he have the hand up, but really, why do you have all this information on pedophiles that you're sitting on, buddy?
Yeah, you're not sharing.
Like, until they embarrass you.
But, you know, in this, like, last section that you read, I think it's just important to recognize the audience of this essay, because it starts to become very clear here that he's writing to, I feel like, somebody who's, you know, drinking with him in a social club. He's writing to incite the masses toward revolution. He's trying to convince wealthy bourgeois people that
it's okay.
It's in their best interest, actually, to have socialism.
Yeah. He's doing the Nick Hanna or special.
Yeah. No, yeah. This would definitely come up in conversation after, like, the latest novel, or, like, after seeing, like, the ballet. Like, also, you know, like, we're a refined people and these landowners, they're trash.
I think that it's an interesting strategy, though. I think wealth should become more of a social, what do you call it? The thing on your back? Social, albatross.
Oh, man, you're kicking my ass with these.
and, like, I mean, I don't know how we do this, but if you have any ideas, @lithangover on Twitter. We'll continue here.
Simply pleasures. Oops.
He's fucking insane, isn't he? His choices are fucking crazy.
I think it's I just want to take another little detour. There was this long standing at Oxford supposedly recording of Wilde speaking. And then it turned out
it was Martin Giessen.
It was not Martin Giessen, but here it is, supposedly. It's not him pointing.
The Palace of Riddling Chair. In Riddling Chair, we find Riddling Chair. There is a
Yeah, he's supposedly reading the Ballad of Reading Jail, but it was turned out to be a fake. But apparently people at Oxford were like, holy shit, we got this.
That seems like too poorly recorded. Like they went into the, like, to prove that it's real, they went a little too far on the poorly recorded end.
Yeah, apparently some audio people determined that the RPM was not up to time. So you can't fool those
audio nerds, technicians. Those freaks.
Property not merely has duties, but has so many duties that its possession to any large extent is a bore. It involves endless claims upon one, endless attention to business, endless bother. If property had simply pleasures, we could stand it, but its duties make it unbearable. In the interest of the rich, we must get rid of it. The virtues of the poor may be readily admitted, and are much to be regretted. We are often told that the poor are grateful for charity. Some of them are, no doubt, but the best amongst the poor are never grateful. They are ungrateful, discontented, disobedient, and rebellious. They are quite right to be so. Charity they feel to be a ridiculously inadequate mode of partial restitution, or a sentimental dole, usually accompanied by some impertinent attempt on the part of the sentimentalist to tyrannize over their private lives. Why should they be grateful for the crumbs that fall from the rich man's table? They should be seated at the board, and are beginning to know it.
I like that.
As for being discontented, a man who would not be discontented with such surroundings and such a low mode of life would be a perfect brute. Disobedience, in the eyes of anyone who has read history, is man's original virtue. It is through disobedience that progress has been made, through disobedience and through rebellion. Sometimes the poor are praised for being thrilled.
That's the most Darwinian section of his theory, that he likens disobedience, and it's almost like talking about like mutation, that things that go against the established order is how progress is initiated. So I feel like he's folding in that theory of evolution right in with like societal history as well.
Yeah, and Wilde was a big was a big fan of Darwin.
Obedience and through rebellion. Sometimes the poor are praised for being thrifty. But to recommend thrift to the poor is both grotesque and insulting.
Are you wearing Nikes?
It is like advising a man who is starving to eat less. For a town or country labourer to practice thrift would be absolutely immoral. Man should not be ready to show that he can live like a badly fed animal. He should decline to live like that, and should either steal or go on the rates, which is considered by many to be a form of stealing. As for begging, it is safer to beg than to take, but it is finer to take than to beg. No, a poor man who is ungrateful, unthrifty, discontented, and rebellious is probably a real personality, and has much in him. He is at any rate a healthy protest. As for the virtuous poor, one can pity them, of course, but one cannot possibly admire them. They have made private terms with the enemy, and sold their birthright for very bad pottage. They must also be extraordinarily stupid. I can quite understand a man accepting laws that protect private property and admit of its accumulation, as long as he himself is able under those conditions to realize some form of beautiful and intellectual life. But it is almost incredible to me how a man whose life is marred and made hideous by such laws can possibly acquiesce in their continuance. However, the explanation is not really difficult to find. It is simply this. Misery and poverty are so absolutely degrading, and exercise such a paralyzing effect over the nature of men, that no class is ever really conscious of its own suffering. they have to be told of it by other people, and they often entirely disbelieve them. What is said by great employers of labour against agitators is unquestionably true. Agitators are a set of interfering, meddling people who come down to some perfectly contented class of the community and sow the seeds of discontent amongst them. That is the reason why agitators are so absolutely necessary. Without them, in our incomplete state, there would be no advance towards civilization. Slavery was put down in America, not in consequence of any action on the part of the slaves, or even any express desire on their part that they should be free. It was put down entirely through the grossly illegal conduct of certain agitators in Boston and elsewhere, who were not slaves themselves, nor owners of slaves, nor had anything to do with the question, really. It was undoubtedly the abolitionists who set the torch alight, who be...
So we'll just stop that there. That's wrong.
Yeah. There's no way that this podcast was going to let... I assume... Are you a Civil War head, David?
A bit.
Yeah, so there's, there's no fucking way between the three of us to be like, actually...
Oh, no, definitely.
Any of you guys want to go first?
Well, I'll just... You guys should jump, maybe jump in the history, but I would just say that, you know, in the socialist tradition, this is a good example of where... you know, Wilde is very deviant from any kind of like Marxist analysis because they very specifically did not attribute the you know, the Civil War to the fact that, you know, some agitators in Boston were causing trouble.
Yeah.
But, you know, a multitude of factors, including the realities of production in the United States, where industrial production was becoming so much more powerful than agrarian production, and that you needed to get rid of the slave system because it was I mean, not only was it you know, immoral and unjust and brutal, but it's also incredibly wasteful. Of especially all the land in the South, and the fact that, you know, most of, especially in the Deep South at that time, most of the Old South, I mean, most of that land had become very unfertile because it had been, you know, just wasted under slavery. And a real reason for the need to expand slavery in the United States was all these people who owned a lot of slaves wanted to keep their money basically by being able to export slaves into other states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we'll talk about... this once we get closer to the slavery portions. We are skipping a little bit ahead to cover Wilde here, but there's like a bunch. This isn't entirely an argument against Wilde, but I was trying to find this work, this abolitionist text written by this African American abolitionist, and it's David Walker, and it's and the appeal. It's a appeal to the colored citizens of the world, and frankly, he was a Boston, but he did live in Boston. He wasn't like a white abolitionist, but he wasn't an abolitionist. So, you know, maybe there's, I guess that's not exactly the, I'm not dunking on Wilde as much as I wanted to with that, but generally speaking, like, there was a lot of slave revolts and the slaves themselves had a huge hand. We'll talk about this in the context. I kind of want to cover, maybe when we do this for the table setting for a lot of the slavery section, we'll do that Stephen Hahn book. A Nation Under Our Feet, I think it is, where it sort of talks about all the different things that like slaves themselves were actually doing to secure their freedom. So this is the probably maybe the most explicitly problematic part of Wilde that you have to sort of like deconstruct. And I think maybe the simplest explanation is, one, this is a bias of a guy from his class and who's a writer, but also he's like you said earlier, of who his actual audience is here.
Yeah. Well, and I think, so just to jump on that one more time, is like in the previous section, you know, he's talking how important it is to have the agitator instead of like the organic, you know, rebellion. And I feel like that kind of perspective is very clear when he's talking about in basically the Civil War in the United States, where it's not, you know, the oppressed themselves taking action. It's very much like people outside coming in and letting everyone know you're being, you know, you're being abused and you need to be helped by us. Which is very much like a kind of upper class bourgeois idea of like how we're going to deal with social problems.
Yeah, exactly. And you can see in a few of these criticisms where conservatives might be like you could read the philanthropy critique as sort of a critique of welfare states and stuff like that too. So you can kind of see occasionally the double, not double edge, but why like libertarianism.org has a essay, has a video on it.
Slavery was put down in America, not in consequence of any action on the part of the slaves, or even less desire on their part that they should be free. It was put down entirely through the grossly illegal conduct of certain agitators in Boston and elsewhere, who were not slaves themselves, nor owners of slaves, nor had anything to do with the question, really. It was undoubtedly the abolitionists who set the torch alight, who began the whole thing. And it is curious to note that from the slaves themselves they received not merely very little assistance, but hardly any sympathy even. And when at the close of the war the slaves found themselves free, found themselves indeed so absolutely free that they were free to starve, many of them bitterly regretted the new state of things. To the thinker.
Yeah, no, absolutely yeah, not wrong. True. Yeah, it's someone who's never cracked a book on the subject, for yeah. sure.
Many of them bitterly regretted the new state of things. To the thinker, the most tragic fact in the whole of the French Revolution is not that Marie Antoinette was killed for being a queen, but that the starved peasant of the Vendée voluntarily went out to die for the hideous cause of feudalism.
Now, he said that that's a good line. I really yeah, like that.
I do too.
It's funny, the Quillette... did you see that Quillette article, David?
Oh yeah.
They did, like, this one massacre nobody's ever heard of before. And it's, like, literally in this text. Like, yeah, it's a well-known thing. But that's all you need to respond. Actually, mm-hmm. Once this is over, I'm going to just... take a picture of this part and respond to Andy No, saying like, here's the correct take on Vendée.
That's right.
Like that's just so awesome to me.
Well, it's mm-hmm. such a great way to frame revolutionary violence, not as a way of denying the fact that it might be like violent or even unethical what's going on, but to frame it in like a much broader, like 1,000-foot view of existence mm-hmm. that there are actually much worse moral atrocities that have been going on that are just known as like everyday occurrences of the feudal state or the ruling class, that Oscar Wilde is both saying like, yeah, it's bad that Marie Antoinette was killed. Like just that's obvious, but it's like a drop in the bucket compared to the existence that the entire peasantry had to live under her.
So Oscar Wilde's first play he wrote, I believe, is called Vera, and it wasn't performed until much, much later because of the political aspects of it. It's about the Russian nihilists and stuff like that. Mm. Here's from the conclusion of this Van de Kamp and Leahy article from a little bit. It says on this Vera or the Nihilists, 1880. So this is about a decade before he wrote this. The play was cancelled in England at the time because of the present state of political feeling in England, as Pearson puts it. It is not difficult to imagine the impact which the heroine, with her flaming red dress of revolutionary sentiments, would have made on the English audience of the time, particularly with statements as, quote, how easy it is for a king to kill his people by the thousands, but we cannot rid ourselves of one crowned man in Europe. And then you see, like, anarchists actually did put a body count up with, mm-hmm. Like, crown princes and, I don't know, Franz Ferdinand and, like...
It does become a movement. I mean,
yeah.
To the thinker, the most tragic for the whole of the French Revolution is not that Marie Antoinette was killed for being a queen, but that the starved peasant of the Vendée voluntarily went out to die for the hideous cause of feudalism. It is clear, then, that no authoritarian socialism will do, for while under the present system a large number of people can lead lives of a certain amount of freedom and expression and happiness, under an industrial barrack system or a system of economic tyranny, nobody would be able to have any such freedom at all. It is to be regretted that a portion of our community should be practically in slavery, but to propose to solve the problem by enslaving the entire community is childish.
Childish.
Every man must be left quite free to choose his own work. No form of compulsion must be exercised over him. If there is, his work will not be good for him, will not be good in itself, and will not be good for others. And by work, I simply mean activity of any kind. Hmm. I hardly think that any socialist nowadays would seriously propose that an inspector should call every morning at each house to see that each citizen rose up and did manual labor for 8 hours.
Orwell wrote a review of this and takes issue with that part, and it's pretty obvious given his historical time why he would.
To see that each citizen rose up and did manual labor for 8 hours. Humanity has got beyond that stage and reserves such a form of life for the people whom, in a very arbitrary manner, it chooses to call criminals. But I confess that many of the socialistic views that I have come across seem to me to be tainted with ideas of authority, if not of actual compulsion. Of course, authority and compulsion are out of the question. All association must be quite voluntary. It is only in voluntary associations that man is fine. But it may be asked how individualism, which is now more or less dependent upon the existence of private property for its development, will benefit by the abolition of such private property. The answer is very simple. It is true that under existing conditions, a few men who have had private means of their own, such as Byron, Shelley, Browning, Victor Hugo, Baudelaire, and others, have been able to realize their personality more or less completely. Not one of these men ever did a single day's work for hire. They were relieved from poverty. They had an immense advantage. The question is whether it would be for the good of individualism that such an advantage should be taken away. Let us suppose that it is taken away. What happens then to individualism? How will it benefit? It will benefit in this way. Under the new conditions, individualism will be far freer, far finer, and far more intensified than it is now. I am not talking of the great imaginatively realized individualism of such poets as I have mentioned, but of the great actual individualism latent and potential in mankind generally. For the recognition of private property has really harmed individualism and obscured it by confusing a man with what he possesses. It has led individualism entirely astray. It has made gain.
I just want to pause on that. The confusing a man with what he possesses. I feel this very strongly, like growing up and going through different sort of, like item fetishes. Like I into cars when I was in, basically because of Fast and the Furious and Gone in 60 Seconds and that shit. I bought a Honda Accord because that was a car that had a lot of like aftermarket parts available for it. Luckily, my money wasn't. I kind of spent all the money on the car and didn't have enough to like put like underglow and like rims on it. And then I aged out of that. And then in college, it was like guitar equipment. So I was like looking at guitar pedals, like on forums and like different sort of guitars and like just different things you can buy. And it is like we're sort of taught to sort of express yourself through buying shit.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it's a complete fetishism. But I do you mind if I jump on this too? Because it's like, I think that's a very important point, and I think that Wilde hits it very well. But I think there's something also that he's missing in a good like socialist Marxist criticism of capitalism, which is it's not just the fetishism of the object, right? Of like wanting that car or like these kind of objects to create the individual. It's also the idea of being a like of because of the division of labor, identifying with a certain job. So if you don't mind, if I can quote real quick from the German ideology, we were talking about this on the show last week. Okay. Yeah. This is Marx in the German ideology when he's laying out a communist society. In communist society, where nobody has one exclusive sphere of activity, but each can become accomplished in any branch he wishes, society regulates the general production and thus makes it possible for me to do one thing today and another tomorrow, to hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, criticize after dinner, just as I have a mind, without ever becoming hunter, fisherman, herdsman, or critic. The fixation of social activity, this consolidation of what we ourselves produce into an objective power above us, growing out of our control, thwarting our expectations, bringing to naught our calculations, is one of the chief factors in historical development up till now.
I remember that section very vividly. I took a 19th century philosophy class as an elective, like I think maybe a freshman or maybe it was my sophomore year. And it was my first time reading Marx. Mm-hmm. And I remember that part being like, damn.
Yeah.
Like, that is it. Like, but at that time, it was such a different time. And like, mm-hmm. I mean, the financial crisis had happened. So like, this world we're in now was starting to unfurl.
Mm-hmm.
But Marx seemed dead. Like, mm-hmm, the yeah. way it was, like, presented to the class was like, yeah, this is some, like,
of course.
Some old stuff. Like, this is, and I'm like, but, like, it seems kind of relevant. Mm-hmm. Maybe, like, and it's amazing to see basically what's happened since then. So, yeah, thanks for bringing that.
Yeah, but, you know, but it's the double move of the commodity, where it's like in the production of the commodity, you lose yourself in being the person who makes the commodity. And then you put all these extra weight that don't exist inside of the commodity because it's socially purposed.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think the Wild quite beautifully described you as essentially being stripped down into an atom. An mm-hmm. atom that yep. is final form is to just be totally destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Like for him, the individual is so important because the individual is so complex, mm-hmm. and that to define it is almost like a perversion. Like he's like this like negative theology form of talking about man.
Yeah.
He says once they're in this system, this capitalistic system, it just gets stripped away and away and away till you're nothing, till you're just like a single atom.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think that's true, but I feel like this is a very important tension between, you know, Marxism and what Wilde is describing, because Wilde still has a conception, at least I feel in the text, that, you know, we will have people who are doing a very specific job, mm-hmm. and that, like, the artist specifically will just be an artist and they won't be participating in the other aspects of life.
Do you think so? I think that,
yeah.
My reading of this is that there is no specific job, that everyone is just...
I think that's true, but I think what Wilde is saying is that like people like him are just going to be, you know, artists or writers, and that's their pure occupation, and that they're not going to participate in, you know, production of what's socially necessary.
Well, yeah, my reading is that he thinks that no one will be doing necessary work, that mm-hmm. it'll all be robots, right?
That is true.
Yeah.
That everyone's going to be an artist in Wilde's utopia, that everyone is yearning to be like him,
mm-hmm.
actually, but he's not some separate class anymore, that everyone's Oscar Wilde. I thought that was my
reading. I don't think that he's arguing for a separate class.
Right.
But I think that he is arguing that, yeah, that is true, that like we're going to, but I'm sorry, I just read that whole machine part as just something that's not very
That's
viable.
What I'm saying. Yeah, exactly. That's the
oh,
thing.
No, for sure.
That's his out, right? His out is machine techno-utopianism.
Machine slavery. Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, this is from Van de Kamp again, page 146 says, like Morris, Kropotkin believed in the benevolent qualities of technology. Cobden Sanderson recalls, quote, I had a long talk with Kropotkin. He was very animated. He hoped that all the necessaries of life would come to be made by machinery, so that they might be abundant and cheap. At present, machinery was in the hands of capitalists and was misapplied, and the hands were enslaved. In the better times to come, machinery would be the property of the commune or community, be directed to social ends, keep always going, and be worked by frequent and short shifts of all classes. The necessary wants of all being so satisfied, all could betake themselves in security of such additional labors of love as might please them, whether on hand or brain or both.
Hmm.
But it is that machinery stuff. I mean, fuck, man, that goes back a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Techno-utopianism. yeah. Maybe artificial intelligence is going to solve climate change.
See,
and all this.
You know, and I hope we're not getting into too much of a tangent, but I don't like that philosophically as an argument, not just specifically Wilde, but even like this idea of, you know, fully automated like luxury communism.
Yeah.
Because what you're asking for is a force outside of history, basically, mm-hmm. to act upon to fix the social system that we mm-hmm. have today.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, you're waiting for Christ.
And what did people say, that fully luxury automated gay space communism or something like that? Wilde has a lot of those. He doesn't have the space part, but
easily the most cringe-inducing thing heard said aloud.
Damn,
I see it sometimes in real life. I'm just like, I can feel my skeleton wanting to leave my own body.
What if that was literally a Wilde?
Yeah, yeah. He's like, get this right.
It's hidden in de profundis.
And you know,
I do like the idea of, you know, utopias. It's something that's just so impossible that, you know, it challenges us to action, even mm-hmm. though I don't know that if I do think that slogan specifically is a little too ridiculous for me. The fully automated gay luxury space communism. But like, I don't necessarily, like, I'm not, you know, like a hardliner on this. It's like, oh my God, well, that's, you know, utopian. Don't ever say that. You know, mm-hmm. for some people, you know, it motivates them and that's worthwhile.
Right. But there's always a higher level conversation to have about it. Right?
And there is a political movement that very much is, you know, oriented on that belief in that that's a historical necessity mm-hmm. for enacting socialism or communism.
Oh, technology.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I would. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, you've had a lot of movements, especially in the U.S. recently, that are, you know, the idea is basically Weil's ideas that, you know, you develop machinery until we can basically enslave machines so that we don't have to work.
Right.
Right. And then we won't have any need to. And, you know, that there's parts of that that are part of Marxism, like the idea is that the machine does give us the potential to mm-hmm. put to work so much less than is, you know, necessary. But I don't know. The idea that, you know, we're going to be able to get there and that we have to develop technology to that point to be able to implement any kind of socialism is always sort of bonkers to me.
Yeah.
Well, it's unfortunate, too, for Weil, just as like a piece of artistry, this essay that it's like he's imagining this utopian world where it's almost unrecognizable, like mm-hmm. almost indescribable. He like only hints at like there's no like familial relations and things like that. And then when he gets to the brass tacks of it for a second, he's like, oh, basically we're having robot slavery.
Yeah.
It's like, what makes you think that everything else will change if really you're just slotting out, you're just giving yourself a moral out?
And you know, who's going to design the robots and who's going to have to,
yeah, Oscar,
you know,
who's
clean
gonna
them?
Design the fucking robots? Yeah.
Oil the machines? I don't know.
Yeah. And he clearly doesn't have any concern for, you know, what robots feel about all this. If they're sentience.
That's where I get worried reading too much postmodern philosophy. That's like, you know, that's the next movement, right? It's like we all these, you know, all these sci-fi movies about the robots uprising. Yeah. You know, humanity. I don't know if this is a good route to go down.
But of the great actual individualism, latent and potential in mankind generally. For the recognition of private property has really harmed individualism and obscured it by confusing a man with what he possesses. It has led individualism entirely astray. It has made gain, not growth, its aim, so that man thought that the important thing was to have, and did not know that the important thing is to be. The true perfection of man lies not in what man has, but in what man is. End of section one. Recording by Martin Giessen. In Hazelmere, Surrey.
If you were wondering where that was.
Yeah. Good job, Martin.
Section
don't listen to
two
him.
Of The Soul of Man by Oscar Wilde. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Vidualism and set up an individualism that is... Section two. Private property has crushed true individualism and set up an individualism that is false. It has debarred one part of the community from being individual by starving them. It has debarred the other part of the community from being individual by putting them on the wrong road and encumbering them. Indeed, so completely has man's personality been absorbed by his possessions that the English law has always treated offences against a man's property with far more severity than offences against his person, and property is still the test of complete citizenship. The industry necessary for the making money is also very demoralising. In a community like ours, where property confers immense distinction, social position, honour, respect, titles, and other pleasant things of the kind, man, being naturally ambitious, makes it his aim to accumulate this property, and goes on wearily and tediously accumulating it long after he has got far more than he wants or can use or enjoy, or perhaps even know of. Man will kill himself by overwork in order to secure property, and really, considering the enormous advantages that property brings, one is hardly surprised. One's regret is that society should be constructed on such a basis that man has been forced into a groove in which he cannot freely develop what is wonderful and fascinating and delightful in him.
That part reminded me of, I think, one of the early... It was around the time, actually, right after I'd read that German ideology, but about free will. And like when you start thinking about free will, it's impossible to not start thinking about capitalism, at least for me. Mm-hmm. Like, it's weird to me that people can start thinking about these things and not come to an anti-capitalist conclusion. Like, even climate change, or like, you independently draw, like, oh yeah, the problem is capitalism. Mm-hmm. But
no, I mean, there's significant limits to your freedom. That are, you know, designated specifically by the way that we produce what we need to survive.
Yeah. And man, I feel like Yuval Noah Harari, he wrote this book called Sapiens. And it basically, the thesis is that like the agricultural revolution was like actually led to human beings. I think it's agricultural. Maybe it was the machine age, but I feel like he's slotting it earlier. But it was like the fall, where it's like we stopped having the sort of like proper relationship with the earth, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And like what you need to do to survive.
Yeah, Wilde pretty much echoes that, but saying that like individualism went off course as soon as we started farming and had a more sedentary lifestyle.
Oh, does he mention farming too?
The recognition of private property has really harmed individualism and obscured it. So as soon as property comes into, which he's citing property all the way back to like, and like even in like an ancient context.
Mm.
So I think anytime like this recorded history basically is like, this is when we've been off the mark.
And that's what Rousseau believes too.
State of nature. I was thinking about that.
Interesting. Yeah.
Considering the enormous advantages that property brings, one is hardly surprised. One's regret is that society should be constructed on such a basis that man has been forced into a groove in which he cannot freely develop what is wonderful and fascinating and delightful in him, in which, in fact, he misses the true pleasure and joy of living. He is also, under existing conditions, very insecure. An enormously wealthy merchant may be, often is, at every moment of his life at the mercy of things that are not under his control. If the wind blows an extra point or so, or the weather suddenly changes, or some trivial thing happens, his ship may go down, his speculations may go wrong, and he finds himself a poor man, with his social position quite gone. Now, nothing should be able to harm a man except himself. Nothing should be able to rob a man at all. What a man really has is what is in him. What is outside of him should be a matter of no importance. With the abolition of private property, then, we shall have true, beautiful, healthy individualism. Nobody will waste his life in accumulating things and the symbols for things. One will live. To live is the rarest thing in the world. Most people exist, that is all. It is a question whether we have ever seen the full expression of a personality, except on the imaginative plane of art. In action, we never have. Caesar, says Mommsen, was the complete and perfect man. But how tragically insecure was Caesar? Wherever there is a man who exercises authority, there is a man who resists authority.
I want to bring up Thomas Jefferson at this moment.
Hmm.
I remember hearing a lot about him as sort of a polymath. When I first learned what that word was in high school, it really appealed to me. And all, basically every founding father is described as a polymath.
Yeah.
I remember hearing on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, which is not as bad as it sounds, but, it's by this guy, Clay Jenkinson. He's an impersonator of both Jefferson and Teddy Roosevelt. But I remember him doing and to be fair, I think Clay he's one of the most famous North Dakotan intellectuals. He deals with like the Sally Hemings stuff, okay. Yeah, exactly. I think he's, way ahead of his audience, but way behind us, I think you would probably say.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Someone who's been attached to Jefferson for like 40 years.
Yeah, that's the other there's problem.
A lot, there's a lot of baggage.
Like, you're inhabiting that a bit, like, yeah, stuff. But anyway, that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is, from that podcast, I learned that Jefferson basically read 7 hours a day and rode horseback.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you can do that when mm-hmm. you're a slave owner. But he was also very tied to, like he had so many debts and things like that too. Like, he's constantly, even for like this amazing, like, person who has all this mm-hmm. mythology around him, it's like kind of a taut, that's not perfect individualism by any sense of the mm-hmm. imagination.
In action, we never have. Caesar, says Mommsen, was the complete and perfect man. But how tragically insecure was Caesar? Wherever there is a man who exercises authority, there is a man who resists authority. Caesar was very perfect, but his perfection travelled by too dangerous a road. Marcus Aurelius was the perfect man, says Renan. Yes, the great emperor was a perfect man, but how intolerable were the endless claims upon him! He staggered under the burden of the empire. He was conscious how inadequate one man was to bear the weight of that titan and too vast orb. What I mean by a perfect man is one who develops under perfect conditions, one who is not wounded or worried or maimed or in danger. Most personalities have been obliged to be rebels. Half their strength has been wasted in friction. Byron's personality, for instance, was terribly wasted in its battle with the stupidity and hypocrisy and philistinism of the English. Such battles do not always intensify strength. They often exaggerate weakness. Byron was never able to give us what he might have given us. Shelley escaped better. Like Byron, he got out of England as soon as possible, but he was not so well known. If the English had had any idea of what a great poet he really was, they would have fallen on him with tooth and nail and made his life as unbearable to him as they possibly could.
Wilde hates the
but he was not a remarkable figure in society, and consequently he escaped to a certain degree. Still, even in Shelley, the note of rebellion is sometimes too strong. The note of the perfect personality is not rebellion, but peace.
And just to follow that up, I don't think Wilde would be like the kind of guy who complains about people getting ratioed on Twitter, like saying that's uncivil. I think Wilde would be more the person who constantly complains about who's writing in the New York Times or something like that. Because a lot of this stuff is very personal. Mm-hmm. Like he's had beef, or people have beef with Wilde. They don't like him for whatever reason. And they just lash out. So it's not when he says the public, or like public audiences, or whenever he talks about that, mm-hmm. it's like it's the reading public, which is like a bourgeois public.
Yeah,
I hear you.
I would give him some pushback, and I'd be curious on what you guys think of like this idea that art could be made essentially in a vacuum. And what's I think sometimes we like romanticize like the mm-hmm. adversity that an artist has to get past. But I do think for some artists, it's required, or like for some art anyways, it is required that there's like pushback. And it's a co-author in its creation almost. Mm-hmm. And we see now with like, I think of like auteur theory with like filmmaking is probably the most brutal example, that sometimes artists left to their own creature comforts and desires, like, will their artistic impulse will ossify, and mm-hmm. they will become very pedestrian in what they create.
And it's like, this is one thing, you know, as a writer, it's like when you have a good editor, someone mm-hmm. who can really get into your work and push back on you, challenge you on your ideas, in my experience, that's going to make your work so much better. And there's a lot of really bad editors out there, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of writers who, you know, have horror stories about working with certain people. But most people who've been very successful will say, like, I've had somebody who was really able to be critical of my work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wilde was himself a pretty bad editor of the Women's World. did you hear that? Did you hear that part in the Emma L. Sullivan book? He basically like would show up at like later and later every day, and
he cut his days
down to like twice a week.
King among women writers.
But that put me off. What were you guys just saying right before that?
Just talking about like dealing with adversity as an artist, and he's basically saying that once all adversity is stricken off, then the artist won't have to waste his time.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can think of is I always like the first couple albums by bands before they're in the sort of record industry, and there's something about those that are they're free of. I don't know how exactly that fits with it, but anyway, let's continue.
Personality is not rebellion, but peace. It will be a marvelous thing. The true personality of man, when we see it. It will grow naturally and simply, flower-like, or as a tree grows. It will not be at discord. It will never argue or dispute. It will not prove things. It will know everything, and yet it will not busy itself about knowledge. It will have wisdom. Its value will not be measured by material things. It will have nothing, and yet it will have everything, and whatever one takes from it, it will still have, so rich will it be. It will not be always meddling with others, or asking them to be like itself. It will love them because they will be different. And yet, while it will not meddle with others, it will help all, as a beautiful thing helps us, by being what it is. The personality of man will be very wonderful. It will be as wonderful as the personality of a child. In its development, it will be assisted by Christianity, if men desire that. But if men do not desire that, it will develop none the less surely. For it will not worry itself about the past, nor care whether things happened or did not happen.
Facts don't matter, nor laws, but its own laws,
nor any authority but its own authority. Yet it will love those who sought to intensify it, and speak often of them, and of these Christ was one. Know thyself was written over the portal of the antique world. Over the portal of the new world, be thyself shall be written. And the message of Christ to man was simply, be thyself. That is the secret of Christ. When Jesus talks about the poor, he simply means personalities. Just as when he talks about the rich, he simply means people who have not developed their personalities. Jesus moved in a community that allowed the accumulation of private property, just as ours does. And the gospel that he preached was not that in such a community it is an advantage for a man to live on scanty, unwholesome food, to wear ragged, unwholesome clothes, to sleep in horrid, unwholesome dwellings, and a disadvantage for a man to live under healthy, pleasant, and decent conditions. Such a view would have been wrong there and then, and would, of course, be still more wrong now and in England. For as man moves northward, the material necessities of life become of more vital importance, and our society is infinitely more complex, and displays far greater extremes of luxury and pauperism than any society of the antique world. What Jesus meant was this. He said to man, "You have a wonderful personality. Develop it. Be yourself. Don't imagine that your perfection lies in the accumulating or possessing external things. Your affection is inside of you. If only you could realize that, you would not want to be rich. Ordinary riches can be stolen from a man. Real riches cannot. In the treasury house of your soul, there are infinitely precious things that may not be taken from you. And so, try to so shape your life that external things will not harm you. And try also to get rid of personal property. It involves sordid preoccupation, endless industry, continual wrong. Personal property hinders individualism at every step." It is to be noted that Jesus never says that impoverished people are necessarily good, or wealthy people necessarily bad. That would not have been true. Wealthy people are, as a class, better than impoverished people, more moral, more intellectual, more well-behaved. There is only one class in the community that thinks more about money than the rich, and that is the poor.
Do you have any takes on his laying bare the secret of Christ?
He's in a long line of people that's like, this is what it's actually about.
Right.
It's closer to the mark, or you could make that argument with the reading, with the text that is present, much more than, say, his Civil War analysis.
Mm.
But this idea that, like Christ saying, like, the kingdom of God is both coming and it's happening right now, many theologians or, like, philosophers have argued, like, that it's a state of mind, almost, like, to use, like, an Eastern sense, and that it's, like, that it's a way of enlightening yourself to realizing what's important, and it's...
Isn't, what it, being born again, wasn't that original meaning, like, I heard from, like, Russell Brand or something like that, but it was like there was a different meaning for born again that I don't know.
It's like there are two births, and, like, this is an idea that is really popular. This is becomes popular again right now, but it's also in first century first century kind of Hellenistic world. This is really important, mm-hmm. that the self has, like, two births, which is, like, your physical birth, and then there's the birth of the soul, which is accumulated over experience that you have with the world. Mm-hmm. And I think Joyce probably is the best part. The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man is a portrait of a soul that's being born. But I was actually just reading a Nietzsche biography that was I can't remember the author, but it was interesting because he's pretty much an exact contemporary of Wilde, and Wilde was able to square that circle of, like, well, we've got to get rid of old morality for the most part, but we can keep it with the, like, we can keep the text itself, because it's like the idea of the Übermensch is right there, that it's like you have to be this perfect self individual. And he's like, yeah, Jesus is saying that all along. So ditch Christianity and take Jesus with you, basically. It's quite clever. It's another one of his paradoxes that it's like, the worst Christian is the best follower of Christ, basically.
Well, and I feel like that's, like, a theme throughout the text. I mean, obviously, he gets into Jesus a lot for the rest of this. But, you know, I mean, in a sense, he's making the argument, at least especially in the first section of this text, that, like, to realize the ideals of, like, bourgeois society, or, like, the things that we think as a society are good, we have to move out of this society. You know, which is, like, the idea of, like, oh, we can have, like, this aristocracy and we can all be aristocrats, right? Mm-hmm. But we'll get rid of – but we'll be in that – without being in the social position that we're in now.
Yeah.
What do you know what I mean? He's like, he's flipping, like, bourgeois society, right? Which is this idea that, like, you have an upper class, and that upper class deserves to be in that upper class, which is why they're supposed to cultivate themselves and to be aristocratic. I mean, that's what the rule, you know, of Aristotelian values comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And he's basically saying, like, we can only realize that actually once we get rid of the class society in general.
Right. Yeah. There's definitely, like, a first shall be last shall be first mentality. And kind of tying, like, Christ's message with, like, the Hellenistic worldview, I think, is really smart on his part. Mm-hmm. And I think I don't think he even sees them as two separate ideas. He's just like, it's all the ancient world to him.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the know thyself dictum, and then saying that's, you know, the Hellenistic catchword. And he's saying it's like, be thyself. So there's this gulf that we're in emotionally. And it kind of recontextualizes the essay that it's like, this is not about so much, like, the material struggle for socialism, but, like, the inner struggle of, like, the human spirit, what it's going to take to get to this moment. I think he kind of etches it out in those two lines, which is, like, right now, like, the gift that Hellenism gave to us is that we became self-conscious. And now, like, our goal is to master ourselves, and whatever that might mean, that we know that we're some sort of autonomous being, and now we have to, like, master that being in some way by becoming an individual, I guess.
Personal property hinders individualism at every step. It is to be noted that Jesus never says that impoverished people are necessarily good, or wealthy people necessarily bad. That would not have been true. Wealthy people are, as a class, better than impoverished people, more moral, more intellectual, more well-behaved. There is only one class in the community that thinks more about money than the rich, and that is the poor. The poor can think of nothing else. That is the misery of being poor. What Jesus does say is that man reaches his perfection not through what he has, not even through what he does, but entirely through what he is. And so the wealthy young man who comes to Jesus is represented as a thoroughly good citizen, who has broken none of the laws of his state, none of the commandments of his religion. He is quite respectable, in the ordinary sense of that extraordinary word. Jesus says to him, "You should give up private property. It hinders you from realizing your perfection. It is a drag upon you. It is a burden. Your personality does not need it. It is within you, and not outside of you, that you will find what you really are, and what you really want." To his own friends he says the same thing. He tells them to be themselves, and not to be always worrying about other things. What do other things matter? Man is complete in himself. When they go into the world will disagree with them. That is inevitable. The world hates individualism. But that is not to trouble them. They are to be calm and self-centered. If a man takes their cloak, they are to give him their coat, just to show that material things are of no importance. If people abuse them, they are not to answer back. What does it signify? The things people say of a man do not alter a man. It is what he is. Public opinion is of no value whatsoever. Even if people employ actual violence, they are not to be violent in turn. That would be to fall to the same low level. After all, even in prison, a man can be quite free. His soul can be free. His personality can be untroubled. He can be at peace. And above all things, they are not to interfere with other people or judge them in any way. Personality is a very mysterious thing. A man cannot always be estimated by what he does. He may keep the law and yet be worthless. He may break the law and yet be fine. He may be bad without ever doing anything bad. He may commit a sin against society and yet realize through that sin his true perfection. There was a woman who was...
It's hard not to read his lifestyle into some of those statements. Like, and him... Because I think that Emery O'Sullivan talks about him having this feeling like he's a guilty man among innocents after he... basically, he starts indulging a lot in homosexuality after he marries Constance. There's an amazing part in the O'Sullivan book where... they're shopping together and they're walking through the shops and he sees a bunch of boys with their face painted. They're, you know, rent boys. Mm-hmm. And he says like terror. He felt complete terror and like the bottom dropped out. Like what the hell? And then he realized like that was a terror of like attraction or something mm-hmm. like that. And it's not that he was, I think, a sort of, unaware of like love between men before, but that like, that moment hit him very hard, like, oh, shit. But
wow.
He may commit a sin against society and yet realize through that sin his true perfection. There was a woman who was taken in adultery. We are not told the history of her love, but that love must have been very great, for Jesus said that her sins were forgiven her, not because she repented, but because her love was so intense and wonderful. Later on, a short time before his death, as he sat at a feast, the woman came in and poured costly perfumes on his hair. His friends tried to interfere with her and said that it was an extravagance and that the money that the perfume cost should have been expended on charitable relief of people in want or something of that kind. Jesus did not accept that view. He pointed out that the material needs of man were great and very permanent, but that the spiritual needs of man were greater still,
self-care.
And that in one divine moment, and by selecting its own mode of expression, a personality might make itself perfect. The world worships the woman even now as a saint. Yes, there are suggestive things in individualism. Socialism annihilates family life, for instance. With the abolition of private property, marriage in its present form must disappear. This is part of the programme. Individualism accepts this and makes it fine. It converts the abolition of legal restraint into a form of freedom that will help the full development of personality and make the love of man and woman more wonderful, more beautiful, and more ennobling. Jesus knew this. He rejected the claims of family life, although they existed in his day and community in a very marked form. "Who is my mother? Who are my brothers?" he said, when he was told that they wished to speak to him. When one of his followers asked leave to go and bury his father, "Let the dead bury the dead," was his terrible answer. He would allow no claim whatsoever to be made on personality. And so, he who would lead a Christ-like life is he who is perfectly and absolutely himself. He may be a great poet, or a great man of science, or a young student at a university, or one who watches sheep upon a moor, or a maker of dramas like Shakespeare, or a thinker about God like Spinoza, or a child who plays in a garden, or a fisherman who throws his net into the sea. It does not matter what he is, as long as he realizes the perfection of the soul that is within him. All imitation in morals and in life is wrong. Through the streets of Jerusalem at the present day crawls one who is mad and carries a wooden cross on his shoulders. He is a symbol of the lives that are marred by imitation. Father Damien was Christ-like when he went out to live with the lepers, because in such service he realized fully what was best in him. But he was not more Christ-like than Wagner when he realized his soul in music, or than Shelley when he realized his soul in song. There is no one type for man. There are as many perfections as there are imperfect men. And while to the claims of charity a man may yield and yet be free, to the claims of conformity no man may yield and remain free at all.
All right, and then we're on to our final part that we're going to cover for today.
Section 3.
Actually, I'll just do a...
Yep.
Since we're here, I'm going to do just the slightest pushback on all of these... I mean, with the addendum that all religious texts are interpretive texts by design and meant to be, you know, that anyone can put some sort of interpretation into it, but that to pull from the gospel narratives that Jesus wants you to be your own person as much as possible is a bit of a stretch. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of a book I saw at a Barnes & Noble once that said, Jesus is a tier one operator, which is
pretty good.
Yeah. Written by is that what it is? Tier one operator? That is the phrase, right? Yeah. Yeah. Written by a guy who's like, I've realized my calling in life is to do this. And I realized that like, that makes me Christ-like. And again, like there are many interpretations, but that's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like the philosophy of Christ would say, no, and you're going to hell for that. I'm not a tier one operator in the same way that it's like, he's not a genie in that sense. It's like trying to make you feel good about all of your choices in life.
Well, and it's very difficult to have a concept of sin.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you have to remove like Jesus's like philosophy with like, this is one of two worlds that we're living in, then it gets a lot more complex. I mean,
there's a possibility of retribution, but there is like a structure. So like there is an act that's like being yourself is not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's not telling you to be yourself so much. Like there are rules I'm trying to lay down here, but it is interesting that he kind of, there is truth to what he's saying about like, he does reject family life in some senses about, and let the dead bury your dead is actually one of my favorite small stories.
I've never heard that before.
In Matthew. Yeah. So he's getting followers in Galilee and this, he's getting some fame, and this young Galilean hears him and he's like, I'd actually love to be a part of your mission. And he's like, okay, well, we're leaving like today. What are you doing? And he's like, well, I'm burying my father. He died. And it's like a 3-day ritual. And And Jesus is like, no, we're leaving now. Like the importance of my mission, which in his mission is essentially to be alive. Mm-hmm. It's like, I'm living right now. Like he's dead. And if you're partaking in this empty ritual that Wilde is talking about, this thing about imitation, like you're dead too. Mm-hmm. It's like, what I'm trying to do is something much more important, which is just to live life, basically. So in that sense, like, yeah, he's absolutely right in that reading.
All right. The final part we're going to talk about, and I'll link to this full LibriVox recording if people want to listen to the remainder.
Section 3. Individualism, then, is what, through socialism, we are to attain to. As a natural result, the state must give up all idea of government. It must give it up because, as a wise man once said many centuries before Christ, there is such a thing as leaving mankind alone.
Okay, what the hell is that? Or the state has got to give it up on its own? Is that the idea?
Yeah, is the part about the state creating what's beautiful, or the state creating what's useful, do we not get to that?
I think we get to that soon.
Okay, yeah, we'll come to it.
Centuries before Christ, there is such a thing as leaving mankind alone. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as governing mankind. All modes of government are failures. Despotism is unjust to everybody, including the despot, who was probably made for better things. Oligarchies are unjust to the many, and ochlocracies are unjust to the few. High hopes were once formed of democracy, but democracy means simply the bludgeoning of the people by the people for the people. It has been found out. Yeah. I must say that it was high time, for all authority is quite degrading. It degrades those who exercise it, and degrades those over whom it is exercised. When it is violently, grossly, and cruelly used, it produces a good effect by creating, or at any rate bringing out, the spirit of revolt and individualism that is to kill it. When it is used with a certain amount of kindness, and accompanied by prizes and rewards, it is dreadfully demoralizing. People in that case are less conscious of the horrible pressure that is being put on them, and so go through their lives in a sort of coarse comfort, like petted animals, without ever realizing that they are probably thinking other people's thoughts, living by other people's standards, wearing practically what one may call other people's second-hand clothes, and never being themselves for a single moment. He who would be free, says a fine thinker, must not conform. And authority, by bribing people to conform, produces a very gross kind of overfed barbarism.
So this is interesting because it reminds me of Frantz Fanon, who is a very important post-colonial thinker. Mm-hmm. He was born in Martinique. He ended up being very pivotal in the Algerian Revolution. But he talks a lot about comparing workers in America versus workers in the colonial areas, especially in Algeria. And he says that it's much more difficult, for example, for a worker in the United States to recognize their oppression and to sort of be able to break through and to implement socialism. Because in the United States, you know, you go to the factory, you work for 50 years, and at the end of it, you're given a watch.
Right.
So it feels very nice versus colonialism, where it's like you see the oppressor's flag. You see the soldiers marching through the streets. You're always very much recognizing where your chains are and like the limitations on yourself versus like this version of freedom that we have in, especially in Europe and in the United States, where you feel free, but you're just being given, you know, a couple bribes.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And that's probably going to be a problem for the foreseeable future, I think, with regards to our current political moment and like the type of struggle we do going for certain policies and things like that. And
authority, by bribing people to conform, produces a very gross kind of overfed barbarism amongst us.
Such a great line.
With authority, punishment will pass away. This will be a great gain. A gain, in fact, of incalculable value. As one reads history, not in the expurgated editions written for schoolboys and passmen, but in the...
That's such a great thing to know, considering what they fucking did to his essay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's funny. He says, editions for schoolboys and pass men. What pass men is type of people who could even get through Oxford, but taking like the pass fail final. Whereas Wilde got what's known as the greats, which I think is like philosophy and history or something, or philosophy. I think philosophy and history or philosophy and literature, something like that.
Yeah, philology, I think.
Okay, yeah. And he like aced it. He was killing it. Even though like he was sort of the bad boy because he had like a bunch of, he was like already sort of the dandy, said like it's hard to live up to your China and stuff like that. Like people were like, he's making a mockery of all this.
Easily the
materialism.
The worst student to have, which is one who's like a genius and an obnoxious piece of shit.
Yeah.
This will be a great gain. A gain, in fact, of incalculable value. As one reads history, not in the expurgated editions written for schoolboys and passmen, but in the original authorities of each time, one is absolutely sickened, not by the crimes that the wicked have committed, but by the punishments that the good have inflicted.
Literary hangover.
And a community is infinitely more brutalized by the habitual employment of punishment than it is by the occurrence of crime. It obviously follows that the more punishment is inflicted, the more crime is produced. And most modern legislation has clearly recognized this, and has made it its task to diminish punishment as far as it thinks it can. Wherever it has really diminished it, the results have always been extremely good. The less punishment, the less crime. Where there is no punishment at all, crime will either cease to exist, or if it occurs, will be treated by physicians as a very distressing form of dementia, to be cured by care and kindness. For what are called criminals nowadays are not criminals at all. Starvation, and not sin, is the parent of modern crime. That indeed is the reason why our criminals are, as a class, so absolutely uninteresting from any psychological point of view. They are not marvellous Macbeths and terrible Vautrins. They are merely what ordinary, respectable, commonplace people would be if they had not got enough to eat. When private property is abolished, there will be no necessity for crime, no demand for it. It will cease to exist.
Supply and demand.
Of course, all crimes are not crimes against property, though such are the crimes that the English law, valuing what a man has more than what a man is, punishes with the harshest and most horrible severity. If we accept the crime of murder, and regard death as worse than penal servitude, a point on which our criminals, I believe, disagree. But though a crime may not be against property, it may spring from the misery and rage and depression produced by our wrong system of property holding, and so, when that system is abolished, will disappear. When each member of the community has sufficient for his wants, and is not interfered with by his neighbour, it will not be an object of any interest to him to interfere with anyone else. Jealousy, which is an extraordinary source of crime in modern life, is an emotion closely bound up with our conceptions of property.
Yeah, for people who don't know the distinction between envy and jealousy... Envy is you want something that you don't have necessarily a right to. Jealousy is when you have a sort of preparatorial claim on something. So you can be jealous of someone talking to your girlfriend, for instance. Or you can be envious that someone has that girlfriend, if we want to just simplify it into the male.
No, those are the only two forms of envy
of
and jealousy.
Possession. Yeah. Yeah.
In modern life is an emotion closely bound up with our conceptions of property, and under socialism and individualism will die out. It is remarkable that in communistic tribes jealousy is entirely unknown. Now, as the state is not to govern, it may be asked what the state is to do. The state is to be a voluntary association that will organize labor and be the manufacturer and distributor of necessary commodities. The state is to make what is useful.
So this...
The individual is to make what is beautiful.
You know, this is just very reminiscent of the famous, it's often misattributed to Marx, but the state withering away, which is Engels and anti-During, which is the idea is that the state will move from the management of people to the management of things. So it's the idea, and when you hear people talk about Marxism, the idea of the state withering away, it's the idea that eventually, like the only thing that the state will move away from, you know, putting people in prison to organizing production on a mass scale.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So what do you have any other takes on like the sort of distinction between the beauty, make what is individual, like, cause that is a role. For the state. That seems to be on the surface of it, a contradiction between the sort of, is that a contradiction for anarchism or is that not?
Wait, to make what is beautiful?
What Wilde's saying about basically does have a role for the state of making what's useful.
Yeah.
How does that fit in with like anarchist traditions?
Well, I mean, it would depend obviously on what type of anarchist tradition. I mean, this is more where socialism starts to blend into anarchism and where people find that there's a unity. And the idea is that the anarchist wants to just abolish the state itself and that will, you know, bring in the society versus the socialist or the communist believes that, you know, we transition society into a way that we start to organize ourselves in a different way. We start to think about objects differently. We start to think about production differently to the point where we won't even notice.
Right.
The disappearance of the state versus something that the anarchists want is that, you know, you just blow up the building and take the flag down and then, you know, we're in a new mode of production.
Yeah. And even though sort of when he says the state should be voluntary, that's not actually that hard for me to imagine in the sense that like, if you start like decommodifying and making as like a sort of right, things like shelter and food and things like that, all of a sudden there is no coercion. You can like say join one of the Green New Deal platoons that's helping to build a new levee, or you could just do something else. Oh my God, that's
just like listed off like just a dreamlike scenario. Like we're gonna make this new bridge.
Hey,
I'm doing it.
This is about utopias, baby.
Yeah.
If there's a podcast without utopias on, fuck that podcast.
Yeah, but they're gonna be like, Alex, we need you to video shoot and edit this video of us building the bridge. I'm like, oh, okay. Okay, cool, I'll do that.
As the state is not to govern, it may be asked what the state is to do. The state is to be a voluntary association that will organize labor and be the manufacturer and distributor of necessary commodities. The state is to make what is useful. The individual is to make what is beautiful. And as I have mentioned the word labor, I cannot help saying that a great deal of nonsense is being written and talked nowadays about the dignity of manual labor. There is nothing necessarily dignified about manual labor at all, and most of it is absolutely degrading. It is mentally and morally injurious to man to do anything in which he does not find pleasure. And many forms of labor are quite pleasureless activities and should be regarded as such. To sweep a slushy crossing for 8 hours on a day when the east wind is blowing is a disgusting occupation. To sweep it with mental, moral, or physical dignity seems to me to be impossible. To sweep it with joy would be appalling. Man is made for something better than disturbing dirt. All work of that kind should be done by a machine.
That line, man is made from something better than disturbing dirt, is one of the more famous ones. That whole section is one of, that's where he's like, he's really heating up there.
Yeah,
that's like hot take zone.
But you know, I will say, like, I don't find too much to disagree with in it, where it's like, there's nothing moral like in itself of doing manual work. So it's like, if we can replace things, like, for example, you know, if instead of vacuuming or sweeping your apartment, you have, you know, one of these, the Roomba or something like that, there's nothing wicked or lazy about that, in my opinion. And I agree with Wilde about that.
And his point about it would be appalling if somebody was doing it like, this is the 8th time I've gone across the street clearing the slush and I'm loving it. Like,
Like,
although I will say, if I could do that, if my job could be shoveling slush, but I could listen to like podcasts and audiobooks all day,
just get like six
I'm
figures.
Getting there.
I remember just actually having a conversation with a friend like the other week. We were getting drinks and I was like, it was like a Friday or something. I was just like, yeah, it's just a sucky work day. And like, oh, what like about it? And it was just like nothing in particular. I just like, sometimes I just do not want to work. Mm-hmm. And then it was something along those lines. I was trying to look for like, you know, camaraderie ship. And then she's like, yeah, I know. I wish we could just go in like for like 5 hours a day. Cause like, honestly, I'd just be more productive then. It's like, I'm not talking about being productive. Like, I'm talking about how much I hate doing things. Like when someone asks me to do work, it like pisses me off.
Yeah. Right.
And should be regarded as such. To sweep a slushy crossing for 8 hours on a day when the east wind is blowing is a disease. To sweep it with joy would be appalling. Man is made for something better than disturbing dirt. All work of that kind should be done by a machine. And I have no doubt that it will be so. Up to the present, man has been, to a certain extent, the slave of machinery, and there is something tragic in the fact that as soon as man had invented a machine to do his work, he began to starve. This, however, is of course the result of our property system and of our system of competition. One man owns a machine which does the work of 500 men. 500 men are in consequence thrown out of employment, and having no work to do, become hungry and take to thieving. The one man secures the produce of the machine and keeps it, and has 500 times as much as he should have, and probably, which is of much more importance, a great deal more than he really wants. Were that machine the property of all, everyone would benefit by it. It would be an immense advantage to the community. All unintellectual labour, all monotonous, dull labour, all labour that deals with dreadful things and involves unpleasant conditions, must be done by machinery. Machinery must work for us in coal mines, and do all sanitary services, and be the stoker of steamers, and clean the streets, and run messages on wet days, and do anything that is tedious or distressing. At present, machinery competes against man. Under proper conditions, machinery will serve man. There is no doubt at all that this is the future of machinery. And just as trees grow while the country gentleman is asleep, so while humanity will be amusing itself or enjoying cultivated leisure, which, and not labour, is the aim of man, or making beautiful things, or reading beautiful things, or simply contemplating the world with admiration and delight, machinery will be doing all the necessary and unpleasant work. The fact is that civilization requires slaves. The Greeks were quite right there. Unless there are slaves to do the ugly, horrible, uninteresting work, culture and contemplation become almost impossible. Human slavery is wrong, insecure and demoralizing. On mechanical slavery, on the slavery of the machine, the future of the world depends. And when scientific men are no longer called upon to go down to a depressing East End and distribute bad cocoa and worse blankets to starving people, they will have delightful leisure in which to devise wonderful and marvellous things for their own joy and the joy of everyone else. There will be great storages of force for every city and for every house if required, and this force man will convert into heat, light, or motion according to his needs. Is this utopian? A map of the world that does not include utopia is not worth even glancing at, for it leaves out the one country at which humanity is always landing. And when humanity lands there, it looks out, and seeing a better country, sets sail. Progress is the realization of utopias.
So yeah, interesting. That's where we'll end it for here. But that on utopias, I've often seen that quote, a map of the world that does not include utopia is not worth even glancing at. Mm-hmm. But the omission of the second part, for it leaves out the one country at which humanity is always landing. I think I've read one essay where it kind of puts that, that's sort of like a bourgeois progress narrative, mm-hmm. a little bit, right? Like, it, progress is a sort of foregone conclusion. We're doing it. We are getting into those utopias, right? Like, maybe air conditioning is a utopia. Maybe PlayStation 4 is a utopia, mm-hmm. right? Like,
it's very teleological.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it's interesting, like that omission, because it does kind of serve a, it's a much more fun quote, I think, if it's just like, if it leaves out the part that, oh, we always without get that. Utopias. Yeah. Hmm. But also it's probably, more, I don't know, I don't want to use the word accurate, but like more, I don't know, thoughtful or something, the way he puts it there. I don't know. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I think it complexifies the concept of utopia. I feel like that's always the biggest slight against the idea of like utopian thinking is that like, that you could possibly reach a terminus point. And what he, mm-hmm. sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, in classic Wilde fashion, he's making utopia pragmatic, which yeah. is the ultimate yeah. oxymoron.
Yeah, or just, yeah, the idea of like defining it clear is like utopia is the furthest point in which we've spiritually been able to get to. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we get there, we'll get to a vantage point where it's like, oh, we can go much further than this. Mm-hmm. Like utopia is is like the liminal point. Mm-hmm. And then once you get there, then all of a sudden you have a much better view. Like that to me is like a definition of like utopian thought. Like that makes much more sense.
And I think it sort of gels with like what probably Wilde experienced, or maybe I'm just projecting mm-hmm. this, but the general idea of human beings like not being sated with any sort of level you attain.
Exactly. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's the thing that's interesting about Wilde. I mean, it makes me think of, you know, like Lacan, like the idea is like with the object that you desire, the objet a, right? Mm-hmm. Is that you have this ideal in your head of like, you know, if I, you know, Matt was talking about this car, right? It's like, if I get this car, I'll be, you know, a hot stud and live this wonderful mm-hmm. life.
Yeah.
And then you get the car and it's like very exciting for a moment. And then you drive it and like, you know, you start thinking about the next thing.
Yeah, exactly.
You're missing immediately.
Yeah.
And it's this impossibility of the satisfaction, which is where like utopia actually, I don't find it to be foreign to like the human mind at all. I think that most people think in utopias. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's something that can be very powerful in motivation. And I will just say, you know, as a Marxist and as looking at the Marxist project, it's like, I feel like, you know, having a utopian bent is like something that can get you very motivated to start becoming involved in politics. Mm-hmm. But then like the real discipline and work is like try to dispel the kind of utopian ideas that prevent you from organizing, you know, properly or implementing that kind of society. Because I mean, this is like, you know, if you look at what Wilde's talking about, I don't know if you could implement, you know, program like this.
Yeah.
You, but you can motivate people. You can wrestle them from their slumber with this, or you can, you know, encourage people to think more boldly. And I think that's where the utopia is really great, is that what it does is it shows the contradictions within our current lived reality, where it's like, okay, well, this is impossible. Well, why is it impossible to us? And certainly, you know, you're going to hit on some limitations of physics when you're talking about Wilde's idea of utopian, but you also really quickly realize, well, capitalism is the first thing that is stopping this from being a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's weirdly like his use of paradox is sort of like, I don't know, this is probably wrong in terms of logic, but it seems to me like the traditional like dialectic, which is thesis, antithesis, mm-hmm. And what's the
synthesis.
Yeah. It seems like he goes like thesis, synthesis, and then both those point to an antithesis that mm-hmm. also makes sense. And it's so like, it's such an interesting formula because it does make you like, it, I mean, it's a cliche at this point, but it does make you think and about things in such a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that his use of paradox works well in this. And then it's like, I'm trying to talk about a world in which the language we have currently can't describe it. Mm-hmm. So it's a twofold, or it has like a double meaning in each of his sentences, which is like, this current world is trash and you can understand it by the way that I can't even explain this, this other world because mm-hmm. I'm just using contradictory terms constantly in a world that is like, the only way we empathize with other people is through suffering. It's like, what if I say we can empathize through many, many other kinds of shades of possibility.
Mm-hmm. And it's also like, you know, he glorifies in a lot of ways, like the criminal element of, you know, of the poor, like the idea mm-hmm. is better to take than to, you know, to receive.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like that's also another way of jarring us a little bit.
Yeah.
You hear that, you're like, oh, wait, that's, you know, that's not typical. And then you realize, well, it's because, you know, this system is immoral itself. And then you take that sky view and you realize that that's the case.
And you know what's funny? A couple modern parallels I'll make quick before we go is, Wilde got sort of publicity and sort of some bad press for talking about anarchist. There's a lot of anarchism going on. He signed one of George Bernard Shaw's petitions. He also sort of played both sides, like in a sort of sister soldier type fashion, where she's like, I can see why somebody would turn to violence if, like, you come up in these conditions of gang violence. Yeah, it's not that big of a difference between like shooting your own brother versus shooting like some old woman in like an area you're riding in, right? Mm-hmm. And Wilde, he's sort of saying like, yeah, violence is bad, but also like these conditions are cultivating it, mm-hmm. right? And that, and he played that line exactly the same, or he walked that a similar line there. Actually, I think that's all I have to say. Do you guys have any other comments you want to get on the record? Well, thanks once again, both of you, Alex, for joining me once again. David, this was great.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun.
No, your addition was very, very welcome. That is it for Literary Hangover, at Lit Hangover, Literary Hangover at Patreon, or patreon.com/literary hangover. I'll put you guys' info in the show notes. Thank you very much. We'll see you next week.